episode number 30. And this is a special show. This is a spotlight on one particular wrestler this week, which mainly the only time I've ever done one of those shows is when somebody died. But this man's not dead yet, but he is one of my all-time favorites, and we're talking about the great Hacksaw Butch Reed. And my guest this evening, of course, I'm your host, Chris Elner, and my guest this evening is a guy I've wanted to have on the show for the past year or so when I started doing podcasts, a man who, if it wasn't for him, I would have pretty much never bought tapes online, as he was the first person I ever bought tapes from. Say a good, 1997, so a good 19 years ago. We're getting old. The man who had probably the best wrestling videotape site on the internet in that era, John McAdam. John, great to have you on the show.
Hey, we can take the word getting out of the word old part for me, dude. I'm 51. I'm there.
Hey, I'll be 37 in August the 9th, so... Yeah, brother, I'm telling you.
I forget what it's like to be 36. That's how in the coffin I practically am. But it's definitely, thank you for having me on. It's definitely a pleasure.
Yeah, and Butch Reed's a guy who I love to death. And, I watched Mid-South as a kid and stuff like that. But it wasn't until you that I was able to get that footage back, stuff I hadn't seen since I was a kid. And my appreciation for Butch Reed grew even stronger than what it already was, seeing this stuff that I was too young to really remember seeing all the way through. And, man, he's just a guy who we'll talk about during the show. One of the guys who in his peak was as good as anybody in the business as a complete package. I mean, he was a phenomenal talent. Had a very interesting career in a lot of ways, so we'll go ahead and delve right into it.
I think extremely highly of Butch Reed myself. To this extent, the probably the number one what if that gets thrown out there when it comes to 80s wrestling is, what if Hulk Hogan never went to the WWF? Who's the top guy? My number one is Hacksaw Jim Duggan. My 1A is Butch Reed.
Well, you know what's funny about that? It's funny you mention that. On YouTube, on Richard Land's channel, he has put up, and I think it's been about a couple of weeks ago, he put up two separate files of All-American Wrestling, the non-WWF matches that they would show on those shows in 1983, mm-hmm. before the expansion really got hit big. Vince was showing AWA, he was showing World Class, he was showing Championship Wrestling Florida. He was also showing Mid-South, and the main guy that he was showing from Mid-South Wrestling was Hacksaw Butch Reed.
I actually remember the day I tuned into USA Network on a Sunday morning, expecting to see Southwest Championship Wrestling, and WWF came on, and it was a bunch of Bob Backlund matches. And this might be heresy, but sorry, that was better than Southwest. And then 3 weeks later, they started airing the old, the stuff from various territories. And in hindsight, it was pretty obvious what McMahon was doing, but, I certainly didn't see it coming.
No, but you look back in retrospect and you look at who he was showing. He was either showing A, the guys he was really interested in, or B, the sons of the promoters. So he was getting in good that way, as he was showcasing a Mike Graham and a Greg Gagne and, of course, Von Erichs, but he won the Von Erichs. But he's showing the sons of the promoters to get in their good graces like that.
And back in the day, his dad would bring in the sons of promoters to Madison Square Garden, which was, the big deal back in the 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, absolutely.
The same guys. I mean, Mike Graham got to do Madison Square Garden. Greg Gagne got to do it. All three of the Von Erichs that were currently wrestling. Probably forgetting someone, but.
Yeah, and let's see. Yeah, he brought in the Von Erichs, Mike Graham, Greg Gagne. I mean, he brought in all those guys as favors. Vince Sr. did. So, and these promoters were looking at it like, they're not going to do anything. Even though they just resigned from the NWA. but they're not going to do anything. Well, they were wrong. But anyway,
yeah.
Butch Reed. Butch Reed's a guy who he played football at Central Missouri. Played for the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yeah, I don't think he actually played for the Kansas City Chiefs. I think he went
preseason,
to a camp.
I think he may have gotten some preseason. Okay. I think. But yeah, I mean, yeah, basically, yeah, he never played a regular season game.
But and I don't even say that disrespectfully. I mean, do you know how good you have to be just to have, just to get invited to a camp?
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, definitely. I mean, and that's the thing, you know, in wrestling, you know, they always talk about Junkyard Dog, play, you know, with the Green Bay Packers, JBL in recent times with the Dallas Cowboys, Jim Neidhart with the Oakland Raiders.
Oh, they, Bobby Duncan, I mean, was an all pro with the St. Louis Cardinals, all pro.
Yeah, and he would actually play. Yeah, I'm talking about guys like JYD and JBL and Neidhart. They never really played. I mean, in a regular season game, never. But yeah, definitely you had guys like Bobby Duncan, Ernie Ladd, of course.
Well, Ernie Ladd was for real. Climbers.
And plenty of other guys, you know, that play football off and on. You know, that went to wrestling. And it's always interesting to me to watch that dynamic of the ex-football players that go into wrestling. And, you know, there's some that made the transition good and some that didn't. And Butch Reed was one who made the transition very seamlessly. I mean, Butch Reed, and we'll talk about this, was a guy that he when the first time you saw him, you was like, man, this guy's got something. He's got a talent here. And but there was other guys like, you know, God forbid, Otis Sistrunk and Ernie Holmes, who were big football stars who tried to wrestle, and they were terrible.
They were beyond awful. The first time I saw Butch Reed, I want to say we first got WTBS out here, October 1981, and it was kind of an interesting way they did it. In the WWF, you had guys that won every week and guys who lost every week. Georgia had kind of a middle class of guys who won sometimes and lost sometimes. Reed was kind of in that middle class. I don't remember him losing any matches as a single, but he would be in tag teams that would sometimes lose. So he was kind of in that group with Tom Pritchard, Bruno Sammartino Jr. type thing. They were undercard guys, but they definitely weren't jobbers. And from the first time I saw Butch Reed, it was like, this guy has something. And I'm not just saying that because that's who we're talking about. Like, I noticed it right away. That guy had something. He wasn't like a – who would be a good comp? Like, he was probably in about the same card position as maybe a Steve Travis or a Rick McGraw in the WWF. But those guys, they're just like, you know, that's their ceiling. That's how good they are. Butch Reed, immediately I could tell, could be something in the wrestling business. Like, he stood out.
And we'll talk about him in Georgia in a minute because he came in Georgia with a hot angle when he showed up there for the first time. But he started out working for Leroy McGuirk, actually, in late 1979. He was trained by Ronnie Etchison, and he started his first big push. Well, not really a big push, but his first push was in McGuirk, who at that point Bill Watts had left early in the year in January. And McGuirk is basically running just Oklahoma and, you know, various other areas around there. And, Bruce Reed, he's known by his real name, not Butch, is there. And he's feuding with guys like Steve Lawler and Don Bass and Steve Lawler, Don Bass, Ron Starr's there. McGuirk's territory this time may have been worse than Central States was. You know, that's what everybody talks about how Central States was bad, and we'll talk about Central States on this show because that's where he goes next. But McGuirk's territory in this time period was pretty damn terrible.
Yeah, I wish I could add more insight to that. It was so terrible it didn't get coverage in any of the magazines. So, except for maybe a paragraph or two in Keitzer. But the one thing I know, Reed was trained, I believe, by Ron Etchison. Do I have the name right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Ron Etchison.
I remember him talking about how, you know, he comes in from football and he's going to do this fake wrestling thing, and Etchison just beat that out of him. He learned to respect the business quickly, and that's out of Butch Reed's mouth, not mine. Yeah. But he learned that, you know, you got to be tough to be a pro wrestler in late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, and Reed eventually went on to have a pretty decent feud with Mr. Pogo in his early days in the United States. They headlined some shows in the McGuirt territory. So Reed was there until about April of 1980, and that's when he went to Central States. And this is where we first start seeing Reed have some real success, as he's hooked up with a young kid named Jerry Roberts.
Jacques Rougeau.
Yeah, also known as Jacques Rougeau. And they become the Central States Tag Team Champions. And Jerry Roberts had did jobs on Georgia television as well in this era. And it's interesting that he didn't use a Jacques Rougeau name. You think it was because that he was afraid that he would be, maybe made fun of as being a Canadian or whatever? I mean, why do you think he went with a different name instead of Jacques Rougeau?
Sometimes I think, especially back in the day, a wrestler is better off in the beginning of his career when, you know, he is looking up at the lights a lot, maybe using a different name and not getting typecast in that job or role. Because that's happened to guys.
It makes a lot of sense, because you want to see them guys later on, if they're young, have that success. And people have that stigma of seeing them, oh, well, that guy, you know, he was nothing but a job guy on television.
Exactly. So, and he also doesn't want, you know, the people back in Montreal to read that, you know, where he is probably, or at least I'm sure he thinks he's going to be a big star someday, reading in the magazines about, you know, how he's losing the opener somewhere in Oklahoma.
Yeah. Now, in this area in Central States, to give you a gist of who he's working against, him and Jerry Roberts are feuding with the Kelly twins, Mike and Pat, the clones, Bob Sweet Tan and Jerry Brown, Super Destroyer and Buzz Tyler. So a motley crew of talent for sure,
yeah,
in the Central States area. And eventually starts teaming up with Rufus R. Jones and Bulldog Bob Brown, and a young kid named Terry Taylor is there as a partner for Butch Reed at one point. So, yeah, Butch is getting ready to move on to bigger and better things. I think his last run in Central States, he was feuding with new lead heel Bobby Jaggers and J.J. Dillon, which is quite the interesting group there. But he goes to Georgia not too long after that, and he makes his Georgia debut on a episode of Georgia Championship Wrestling, which would be known for another thing that happened on that same day, because if I'm not mistaken, that was the same taping that Bruiser Brody made his TBS debut. And Bruiser Brody on Turner was quite the sight, John. I mean, he ran wild in that studio, unlike very few did in that era.
He was amazing in that studio, and you could tell Gordon was like a little bit like, okay, this guy's really crazy. I'm scared. He was one of my, I think Brody was one of the most underrated interviews out there. Like when he'd pull his mouth apart and say, you know what? I got a big mouth. Come shut it.
This is right before Brody is becoming that big nationwide star. And this run, I think, was as key as anything to propel him to that level, don't you think?
I think it definitely helped. I mean, I think at the time, the pull of WTBS as far as getting these guys exposure was a little bit underrated. I mean, I know a couple of wrestlers who were talking about, like, by 82, you definitely wanted to pay the airfare, get out to Atlanta, and be on WTBS to get the exposure. So, you know, Brody was supposed to be a really smart guy. I wouldn't be surprised if he was a couple of years up on everybody else on that.
Yeah, and the deal was that Brody actually debuted, I think, the week earlier. But the thing is about Brody and Bruce Reed was the match was Bruce Reed and Bobby Garrett, who was a known job guy on George Television, against the Fabulous Freebirds, Terry Gordy and Buddy, Terry and Buddy by DQ. Uh-oh. And Reed got as much offense on the Freebirds, John, as most of the big names did in that match. Oh, sorry, John. I had myself on mute.
Okay. I was wondering what happened there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was on mute for some reason. I hit mute by mistake. But anyway, no problem. Reed made his debut. I mean, Brody made a debut the week earlier than Reed did. But Reed made his debut on May 30th, 1981. And he was teaming with a longtime Georgia jobber, Bobby Garrett, who he did a lot of jobs in the area. In fact, Dusty Rhodes broke his arm by mistake on an episode of George Championship Wrestling not too long after this.
I remember
and
that.
And they teamed up against Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts, who were the Fabulous Freebirds and tag team champions at the time. But Reed, it's his first match in, although they showed a video of him from Central States the week before. So you know there's something going on here. He comes in, and he has as much offense against Terry and Buddy as just about anybody did in the territory at the time on television. I mean, what are your memories of Butch Reed's Georgia debut?
You know what? I didn't get to see it live. I did get to see the match on tape, and I was unaware that was his debut. But again, going back to what I was saying earlier, you could tell that he wasn't just an underneath guy. And the way they did that was, they lost the match because he got stuck with Bobby Garrett.
Yeah, and then they did the deal with Brody on that show where Brody was beating up some random job guy. And Reed came out, and eventually it ended up being a confrontation between the two. And it led to actually a lights-out match at the Omni the next night. So they put him out there real quick.
I was unaware of that. Now, I'm guessing Reed lost that match, but it's always good to have a high-profile match like that.
He won by default.
Huh.
Yeah. Brody walked out. Well, Brody had wrestled. Okay, I think the story was that Brody and Abdullah had a match that night, and Reed had a match too. Reed beat this young guy named Jim Duggan, which is interesting.
Yeah,
and big Jim Duggan, and then Reed and Brody had a lights out match, and I guess that Brody and Abby had their big match, and Brody probably wasn't in condition to wrestle, so that gave Reed a win by default in a lights out match, which, you know, that's interesting how that turned out. But I mean, he was in, like, the next night he worked the main event in Augusta. It was an elimination match. It was him, DiBiase, and Tommy Rich against Bobby Eaton, Michael Hayes, and Buddy Roberts. The only man left in the match, the sole survivor, was Bruce Reed.
Man, I did not know about that.
So that shows you, I mean, how the booking at the time, Buck Robley was booking. So that shows you that Buck Robley is kind of getting into Reed, and they want to do something with him. And you look at Reed's working guys; he's still working those some of the lower card guys though on other house shows, Brian St. John, The Angel, Frank Morrell. But still, on television, he's teaming with Tommy Rich. He's teaming with DiBiase and Steve-O and Six Mans. He's getting these matches. He's working with Duggan a good little bit on house shows. But still, you see that they're protecting him.
Yeah.
They're trying to do something with him. And then the booking changes. Buck Robley is gone, and George Scott comes in. And like most booking changes, John, over the years, you know, I mean, bookers are going to use guys that they want to use. And then that's when you start seeing Reed. They transition him more to a tag team with George Wells, who's another football guy and the guy he would be known with later on in Mid-South. What do you think about George Wells and maybe remember his tag team with Reed? What are your thoughts about those two as a team?
I know wrestling is a work per se, but nothing got me madder when Master G got a pinfall over Butch Reed in Mid-South, because I didn't think that much of George Wells in the ring. I thought he was pretty terrible. pretty devoid of charisma, not a very good interview. He was basically the mirror opposite of Butch Reed.
Yeah, and here's an interesting match with those two as a team. At the Omni, on July 5th, 1981, Bruce Reed and George Wells beat Terry Gordy and Greg the Hammer Valentine.
Yikes. Valentine was one of the biggest stars in the business at that point.
Yep. So they put Reed and Wells, they were putting Reed and Wells over, but Reed and Wells was in a tag team that wasn't really going anywhere. They weren't getting any traction. Although they did have a really fun TV match with Gordy and Jimmy Snuka, where they won by disqualification. And the Gordy Snuka team, John, if that had lasted, oh my God.
Oh, I mean, they one of the best teams I've ever seen. And another Butch Reed, George Wells parallel. Remember in 87 when George Wells dyed his hair blonde in World Class?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's funny how Butch Reed and George Wells' careers kind of intertwine here off and on. But
it's like the movie Reed's Twins. One guy's Schwarzenegger, the other guy's Danny DeVito.
Yeah. Well, listen to this match. Columbus, Georgia, July 22nd. DiBiase, Reed, and Rich over Gordy, Patera, and Snuka.
Gordy, I mean, Patera, and Snuka were like the three baddest dudes ever to appear on TV together. Those were three guys you would not want to run into in the wrong place.
Yeah, and of course, they had that infamous moment where Gordon's telling the fans, do not try this at home, as they're using the sledgehammer to break the bricks, and then Gordy gets on the mic and says, dude, fans, try this.
And Gordon lost it. I remember that. That was great.
Yes. So, yeah, Reed, he makes it pretty much through August. And he's working. He has a really good little TV match with Mass Superstar in August. And then that was the last we saw of Reed in Georgia. And then he went back to Central States and worked there for a little bit. But he would start his biggest run of his career is coming up as he goes to Championship Wrestling from Florida.
Yep.
And this is where Butch Reed becomes a major star in the business as Dusty brings him in and decides he's going to push him as his top black babyface. And he comes in, and in January, he's teamed with the Briscoes, helping them out. He's teamed with Mike Graham against Masafuchi and Atsushi Onita. So he's getting in the mid-card, but he's getting wins. And they put him with Sweet Brown Sugar Skip Young, and they start going over guys. Like, here's a match with Butch Reed and Sweet Brown Sugar over Terry Funk and the Iron Sheik. That's a team right there, folks.
Yeah.
And then Butch starts feuding with Dory Funk Jr. over the NWA International Heavyweight title. And these matches aired on All Japan Classics, at least one of them, from the Bayfront. And really strong match. Butch was a guy, I don't know if you would consider him a Dory-type opponent, but I think their styles meshed. I know Dory gets – a lot of people don't really care for Dory anymore and like a lot of the rewatching. They think he's boring. But what were your opinions on Dory Funk Jr.?
Well, I used to see Dory in Florida on cable. Dory's one of the best heels I've ever seen. He knew how to be like the sneaky, conniving, smaller heel, I guess I should say, almost better than anyone. And it almost worked to his advantage that he came across sort of as an older, like, you know, oh, he used to be NWA champion. This guy's trying to cling to that now. And he used Eric as his pawn, you know, making him call him Mr. Funk on television. That was some great stuff.
Yeah, David Von Erich is an integral part of the whole deal, too, with Butch Reed. And yeah, they have quite a few matches together. And David Von, if you haven't seen David Von Erich as a heel in Florida, you're doing yourself a disservice because that was the best run of his whole career.
Absolutely. And my good friend Jeff Bowdrin probably put it the best way. He was like Tully Blanchard, but a foot taller.
That's a great point.
And he looked like a praying mantis.
Yes.
David,
and he was so good,
ugly, and he was huge, and I think he would have been a huge star had he survived.
Yeah, and like you're looking at right here, Miami, February 10th, 1982. Butch Reed and Sweet Brown Sugar over Terry Funk and David Von Erich in 20 minutes and 29 seconds.
And it was absolutely believable. For 1982, Reed and Sugar were over as a team, and that result, you know, it didn't blow your mind at the time.
No. And then, like I said, and he's facing Dory for the international. Listen to this match, February 21st in Orlando. The Funks and David Von Erich over. Butch Reed, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Jerry the King Lawler.
Yeah, Lawler appeared, both Lawler and Mr. Wrestling 2, starting right around spring of 81 through about the end of 82, appeared on Florida sporadically, but regularly.
Yeah. Lawler was there quite a bit in that year time span. Yeah. It was interesting to watch him in Florida.
I wonder what was going on with Lawler at that time, because not only was he in Florida a lot, but he had a brief run in Georgia as a heel. They built up a feud with Roddy Piper, which wound up going nowhere. But talk about what would have been a dream feud in 1982.
Yeah, because Piper got fired.
that Piper got fired, so they just let Lawler go too? I didn't know that.
No, what happened was Piper got fired, so the Omni match ended up being Lawler against Tommy Rich.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, they were supposed to. And then Lawler had worked. Remember, Lawler had worked in Georgia in 81. He came in for a TV shot in 81. And see, that was the whole deal. Because he came in, it's like, how are you fans cheering this guy? When I was here last year, you were booing him, you know?
Okay.
It was like that. It was that type of deal, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, and Lawler had been in Georgia as a heel in the early mid 70s as well, so. But
yeah,
that was before he became like the biggest attraction in Memphis.
Yeah, that was right before. Yeah, because Jerry Jarrett was booking Georgia at the time, and Lawler was, he's a pretty big name in Georgia for that time he was there.
Yeah.
But you look at it, Reed and Dave Von Erich having Texas Death matches. Then we got the bounty matches, Dorian and Butch Reed. Dorian Butch Reed was going all over the place. It was one of the big deals in Florida. Then it had a number one contender lumberjack match in Tampa for the NWA World Heavyweight title on March the 9th where Butch beat Dory. So there's the way to get Flair.
Uh-huh.
And then you have a match in Tampa the next week. Butch Reed and Sweet Brown Sugar over Ric Flair and Terry Funk. Where Reed beat Flair. So there's your setup.
Yep.
And a Ric Flair-Terry Funk team in 1982.
That's pretty
Sounds
incredible.
Delicious.
I mean, that's the way they did things in Florida, though. They were not afraid to feed new talent, rising new talent, the big name stars. I mean, they did it the next year with Mike Rotunda.
Yeah, and they start immediately going around the horn with Reed and Flair doing double disqualifications. And here's another interesting match here from Homestead, Florida. One of their spot shows on March the 17th. Butch Reed and Sweet Brown Sugar over David and Kerry Von Erich. That's right. Kerry Von Erich as a heel in 1982 Florida.
Now, I'm sure you've seen this angle where Flair is out there with a girl on TV in Florida, and he puts the girl between he and Butch Reed. Which at the time, well, the first time I saw it, I thought it was hilarious. Just great heelsmanship right there. And the Von Erichs were right there, Kerry and David. And somehow they wound up getting into it with Flair and Reed. But Kerry was acting as Flair's henchman.
Yes, think about that, folks. Kerry Von Erich was working as Ric Flair's henchman, him and David. Again, this is stuff that, you know, only people that saw it at the time were people that were watching that television, whether it was in Florida or in New York or wherever that was airing at the time. They were the only ones that were seeing that stuff until the tape trading days and the internet, you know?
And believe it or not, Kerry was a very effective heel. He only had to do it on TV for a week or two. But he came across as the rather stupid and very stuck-up son of a famous athlete. He pulled it off quite well.
Yeah. And then they do a deal where, you know, Flair and Reed is having their match. And Reed is just beating the shit out of Flair. And then Dory Funk Jr. and Dave Hunter have to save Flair. Because Reed's beating his ass so bad.
Yep.
I mean, that's something. I mean, that's, you know, Dusty or whoever was booking Florida at this time period. I don't know for sure because Dusty was in and out. But, I mean, that's a way of getting somebody over. You know, if you want to get somebody over as a major league deal, just beating the hell out of the world champion and doing these, you know, angles on television. I mean, that'll do it. And Reed was effective. Reed was a guy who, you know, he looked like $1 million already, and he was cutting good, effective babyface promos at this time as well.
Yes, he was, and they weren't the kind of promos that you see like a John Cena do. They were more of like a Dusty Rhodes everyman promos, and you know, you got where this guy was coming from.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely was a guy who, you know, eventually his nickname in WWF was The Natural, but he really was a natural in the business.
Definitely. And, you know, if we just want to talk about Dory for a minute. Dory, I talked about what a great heel he is. Think about the history he had in Florida as NWA champion, the guy who, you know, consistently, I want to say, slammed the door on Jack Briscoe, the local hero, but, you know, just kept Jack Briscoe away from the title for so long. So he has a rich history in that area.
Yeah. Dory became the booker in 81 in Florida and pretty much homesteaded in Florida after that. We did our show with Barry Rose on the 25 Greatest Angles in CWF history. And, you know, me and Barry were talking about the Dory situation. Dory, he came into Florida in the 70s, but it wasn't as often as Terry did. But then when Dory got the book in 81 for the first time, then you're seeing Dory a whole lot more than you. I mean, he stayed around for most 81, 82 with the Crockett, came back to Florida, went to Crockett, came back to Florida. So it's basically where he was spending his time between Crockett and Florida in the 80s for much of the decade.
But in Japan.
And good for him. Yeah, of course, Japan. Yeah. I mean, that was his main gig. But yeah, I mean, good for him. Stay in the South. That's what I say. Here's an interesting match. May the 9th in Orlando. Butch Reed, Sweet Brown Sugar, and Barry Windham against Jimmy Garvin, David, and Kerry Von Erich. That's right. Jimmy Garvin and the Von Erichs as a six-man tag team. I love it.
Supposedly, that is how Jimmy Garvin got his big push in Dallas, is because he became good friends with David Von Erich down there.
Well, that helps. And in that era, you know, that's how you networked. You know, you got to be friendly with guys and you become a member of their crew or whatever. You know, that's how you bounce around from territory to territory.
Yeah, and it's funny. We're talking about a time where Jimmy Garvin, you know, found the gimmick that made his career. For a long time, it looked like he was going to be just another guy. And then he found the Gorgeous Jimmy gimmick.
Yeah, this is the beginning of that when he's with J.J. Dillon.
Uh-huh.
And it's a different type of Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin than you saw in World Class. He didn't have it yet. He was working on it. It was evolving. Because it was just J.J. Dillon's manager, not a female valet.
They actually did bring in a female valet for him. J.J. Dillon gave him, I'm trying to remember the girl's name or at least what they called
her. The original Precious. Her name was Precious.
Okay, yeah. J.J. gave her to him as a gift in what was a really good TV segment.
Yeah. All right, here we have Flair and Butch Reed now doing 60-minute draws around the loop. So, yeah, I mean, Reed's, again, he's right there with Dusty as like the top baby faces in Florida. And he won the NWA International Heavyweight title, which is very interesting because that's an All Japan title.
Yep.
But Reed beat Dory for the belt. And didn't go to Japan with it either. It was one of those deals where he won it and stayed in the United States. So he didn't have to go to Japan.
There you go.
But you, as you're going through the year of 82, you see more of the same. Brian Blair starts teaming with him and Sugar Sum and Six Mans. He beats Harley Race clean in a number one contender match for Flair in Orlando on June 27th. Him and Sugar are the North American Tag Champions at one point. And then an old friend comes in, Bruiser Brody.
Yep.
And Big John Studd show up in Florida. And they do this deal where John Studd's doing a body slam challenge, which, you know, they took that around the horn. And Dylan says that, well, you got to slam Bruiser Brody first.
Now, so, I always got...
Reed, go ahead.
Out of that, like, you know, Bruiser Brody being like the kind of the Robin to Big John Studd's Batman.
Yeah, it's amazing, huh? Brody is Studd's, like, his underling. Yeah, exactly, like his Robin. You gotta go through him first before you get to John Studd. But you look at it, I mean, if you think about it from a point of view from 1982, that kind of makes sense. Because John Studd had more of a cachet on a mainstream level than Brody did at that time.
It's close. Brody did headline Madison Square Garden. Studd was still kind of just getting started. He had been on TBS, yes.
Yeah, him and Super Destroyer were national tag champions.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, so they were both kind of – Brody was already a huge star in Japan. I mean, but you know what? At the end of the day, it doesn't matter. This is Florida TV. Studd's the guy they're pushing.
Yeah, and Studd, of course, had worked for Crockett and had worked at, you know, other places too. But, yeah, Studd was the main guy. So Reed slams Brody and then picks Studd up. Brody attacks him. And, of course, you know, what happened next. They had a beatdown, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But this led to cage matches between Brody, Studd, and against Dusty and Butch Reed. And I've seen the clips of this stuff, and it's really fun to see that dynamic. That's like a weird four-man dynamic there, but it really worked here.
It did, and, you know, you're looking at, you know, just from a normal fan back in 1982 standpoint, you're looking at Brody and Studd, you know, two monsters. I mean, those are like the original Twin Towers.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at results here, man, and they're putting Reed over Brody in singles matches.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's by pinfall directly, but he's going over him. Listen to this match.
Speaking of those, well, that those wrestlers, I have an anecdote for you. Now, I am at a WWF show in Kingsborough, Massachusetts. It was either December 82 or January 83, and Studd's on the show. And this guy is behind me. Now, mind you, we didn't get Florida on TV. This guy is right behind me is screaming about Butch Reed slamming John Studd. So I turn around, I'm like, okay, how do you know about this? And he's like, oh, through the magazines. I'm like, all right. Because very few people actually got the magazines, but I wound up right in front of one of the guys that did.
That's amazing.
Yeah, my friends are all like, why are you talking to strangers? And I'm like, I just want to. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the magazines were a big deal then, you know, and if After covered it, you know, which I'm, you know, obviously he did, or whoever covered it, that went into the territory. And that's one thing about that. When you do a deal where John Studd is doing this body slam deal, and you're claiming that nobody can body slam him, but it's been done in the territory. Well, yeah, so-and-so did that.
Yeah.
It kind of hurts you.
But it was like pre-internet, before, you know, everyone knew everything that went on all over the place. I was just like, my mind was blown that someone actually knew who Butch Reed was and they slammed John Studd.
Well, speaking about blowing your mind, listen to this lineup for August 21st. At the Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg. This is an amazing lineup. Your opening match, Kevin Sullivan over Derek Draper, who would become Ed Wiskowski, Colonel De Beers. Kamala over Terry Allen.
I had no idea Kamala even worked Florida.
Yep, as managed by JJ. Jimmy Garvin over Mike Graham by disqualification. So there's your Florida match. This one, this six man. Jerry Lawler, Butch Reed, and Barry Windham over Bruiser Brody, Dory Funk Jr., and Big John Studd by disqualification. Lawler, Reed, and Windham as a six-man tag team. It gets better. AWA World Heavyweight title match. Nick Botwinkle over Sweet Brown Sugar.
And Sugar was a big star down there. He wasn't a big star nationally, but he held the Florida title. He held the tag team titles. You know, he was, you know, he got over there.
And that's what helped Reed out tremendously, was the rub from being with Sugar, for being his tag partner.
Yeah.
And, you know, being his equal. And then your main event, barbed wire match, Dusty Rhodes and Terry Funk as a tag team over Kendo Nagasaki and King Tonga. That was a show that happened, folks. August 21st, 1982 in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Two quick things. They pushed Nagasaki to the moon. Someone must have seen how big Kabuki got over in Texas and decided to create their own. I'm not saying he didn't get over, but I don't think he got over to the expectations that they wanted. Secondly, so Sweet Brown Sugar, this is when I was getting Florida wrestling on cable. He comes on TV one week, and they're having a match, I think, against Sergeant Jacques Goulet, and he says that, you know, win, lose, or draw, I am unmasking at the end of the match. There was such a huge difference between him in the mask and without the mask, because the mask kind of gave him a charisma that Skip Young just kind of didn't have.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. He never was the same performer when he wasn't masked. The mask definitely added something special to his gimmick.
And, you know, I don't know. I know a lot of guys who do not like wearing masks because they're hot, you can't see in them, et cetera. But at some point, I would think he would say to himself, wow, I got over way bigger as Sweet Brown Sugar than I did without the mask, Skip Young. I don't know why he thought anything would change, but.
Well, Skip Young, if you read stuff about him and heard stuff about him, he wasn't the most sane, level-headed guy outside the ring.
You oh, put it better than I did. I know a few people who just did not like him.
Yes, he eventually became a big-time crack addict, too. So, I mean, he had a lot of problems.
Oh, boy.
A lot of problems. Hey, how about this team? On September 19th in Orlando, 82. Bruiser Brody, Kamala, and Big John Studd over Brian Blair, Butch Reed, and Barry Windham. Brody and Kamala together as a team.
Yeah, you know, not to get too far off the Butch Reed subject, I don't like that they did stuff like that. Like, if you had a Kamala or an Abdullah the Butcher, they're not supposed to be in tag team matches. They don't get it. They're savages or whatever. I was saying that when I was a kid.
It was the Florida thing. I think that Florida's one of those deals where they kind of treated it, wrestling, more as a sport than other territories did.
Very much so.
Even though they had crazy gimmicks.
Yeah, no, they very much treated it much more like a real sport per se. They you know, they didn't do too much stupid stuff.
Until Kevin Sullivan.
Until Kevin Sullivan, yeah.
Yeah, and we're getting to that era now as you know, this is the era where Sullivan's, you know, about to turn. So you got like your main event at Tampa on October 12th, 1982, is Ernie Ladd is there. Ernie Ladd and Big John Studd over Dusty Rhodes and Butch Reed. So that's like the last of the run. We got Terry Funk and Ernie Ladd over Dusty and Butch Reed by DQ. Angelo Mosca's there. So they got a lot of ex-football players,
yeah,
you know, hanging out in Florida at this time period. But Reed has he pretty much has a run that goes from January to October. So again, this was a run that really set him on fire and got him ready for what was coming next.
Yeah,
and was coming next?
I was going to say, just from reading the magazines, it appeared obvious that, you know, we have a future superstar in Butch Reed on our hands.
Yeah, and he makes his return to Atlanta on October 23rd, 1982 on television. And on the same episode that Jerry Lawler was on. Yeah, he wrestled right after Lawler. Lawler worked Mike Jackson, and Butch Reed worked Mike Thompson. And then Reed's starting to work the house shows in November. And this was one of the last, like, really good time periods of Georgia. This right here is, you got your, I call it like your triple threat type of baby faces and heels. As your top three baby faces at this time was Paul Orndorff, Tommy Rich, and Butch Reed. And your top three heels was Buzz Sawyer, Ivan Koloff, and Ole Anderson. Mass Superstar and Super Destroyer were mixed in as well. But it seemed like that that group of six were bouncing off each other in your big matches and your main feuds. And, John, I know you've watched as much Georgia as anybody has of this era. And, I mean, do you agree that this is like the last of the great period of Georgia Championship Wrestling?
It is either it or close to it. I remember early 83, they were doing Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch against Iron Sheik and Ivan Koloff, which I enjoyed. But it seemed like there was starting right around the end of 82. I want to say more early 83, just a real exodus of talent. But you mentioned Orndorff and Reed. These are two guys you look at, or I was looking at the time, and I was saying, yeah, I could picture these guys as NWA champion right now, never mind in a couple of years. That's, you know, that's how much I thought of them.
Both former football players. Orndorff played at Tampa.
That's right.
You know, University of Tampa, he was a running back. So he's another guy, you know, that we can talk about. He was drafted by New Orleans Saints. So he's another guy that fits in that criteria. Yeah, Orndorff was awesome in this era as a babyface.
Yeah.
He was really effective as a babyface in this era. And, yeah, Paul Orndorff's a guy, Light Reed, I definitely thought had the potential to be an NWA World Heavyweight Champion down the line.
Yeah, and you look at Orndorff. And you can tell, I mean, he's out there in a suit. He's got his national championship belt. I mean, he looked the part.
Yeah, he was a guy that he carried himself well. He was, like, subdued in promos. But he was a different Paul Orndorff than you've ever really seen. You know, he would get fired up, though, in certain angles, but he's just a totally different guy than WWF Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff.
Oh, totally different. And let's face it, it is Georgia where, you know, they're a little more serious. They would give an interview similar to that of a football or a baseball player, whereas the WWF, aside from really, you know, Bruno Sammartino and Bob Backlund, you didn't have guys like that.
Oh, no, it's a totally different universe, no doubt. Well, Butch Reed's big angle at this time in Georgia is with Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer. And, you know, people remember the Tommy Rich Buzz Sawyer feud, you know, because, I mean, it lasted for a full year plus. But the Butch Reed Buzz Sawyer feud also had a very interesting gimmick match on its own. As at the Omni on Christmas night, hair versus hair.
Yep.
Steel cage match. Butch Reed beats Buzz Sawyer. And they went the next, how many months you say on television? Like 3 or 4 months?
With Sawyer with the headgear?
Maybe 5. Yeah, where Buzz is wearing headgear and anything he can do to hide the fact that he had his head shaved, which is so funny because Buzz Sawyer before barely had any hair in his head anyway.
And how old was I? I think I was 17 at the time. Even at that age, I saw right through that. You know, I'm like, okay, they're having the guy who has no hair, losing a hair match, and they're dragging out this thing with the headgear. And I didn't even know. I knew what the concept of booking was, but I had never heard the word. And I knew it was just terrible booking.
Well, who was booking George at this time?
A guy with a funny first name. I've never heard anyone with the name Ole before. And I think
Booker named Oley.
This happens. I'm not trying to be disrespectful towards the guy. It happens in every sport. You know, 10 years ago, this guy was a great coach, but now he stinks. Oley, I am my understanding, he was a great Booker at one point, but in 1983, man, he was stone cold terrible. There was no quality control over that product whatsoever.
And he's trying to do some good things, but. And in fact, he's going to give up the book to Buck Roby again. Buck Roby gets the book for a month coming up in 83. But, yeah, and you look at this Omni card, it drew 13,000 Christmas night. And you got Terry Gibbs over Ken Timms, Joe Lightfoot and Les Thornton going to a draw, Johnny Rich over Chick Donovan, Tommy Rich over the Iron Sheik. You have Andre the Giant, Stan Hansen, and Tito Santana over the Great Kabuki, Mass Superstar, and Super Destroyer. You have national tag titles, the Wild Samoans going to a doubles qualification with the Moondogs. That's right, that match happened. The Russia chain match, Ivan Koloff over Paul Orndorff. And your Reed Sawyer cage match.
This is Christmas 82?
Yes.
Okay. Because the first shot, the open shot in the wrestling war was when Vince got the Samoans to just ditch Georgia without any notice. And...
yeah,
this might have been like their one of, if not their last match there.
Let me check here. I think you may be right. Yes, it was their last match, and that match only went 2 minutes and 35 seconds.
Well, I wonder what was going on behind the scenes, but I remember Oley getting on TV and saying that, you know, well, the Samoans just got up and left, and wherever they went to, the wrestling must not be any good. Like, whoa, what's going on here?
He carried the hell out of it.
Because, you know, back then I had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. And, you know, for a wrestler or whatever Oley was on TV to go out and say something like that was just like, you know, quite memorable.
Oh, yeah. So you go to January and Buck Robley's in his booker now because Brody's there. That's how you know who's booking. And we get our first Reed Flair match in Georgia. As Butch Reed beats Ric Flair on January 23rd, 1983, at the Omni in a $5,000 challenge. Flair was putting up $5,000, you know, if he could be beaten, and he was. And stuff like that I thought was cool when the world champion would do some stuff like that where he wouldn't put the title on, but he put money up or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you get over the guy's a threat, he beats the champion, and you come back and do the match for the title the next show. It's simple but genius booking.
And sometimes when it comes to wrestling, especially, keeping it simple really does work.
Yeah.
And we're going to get to that when about Butch Reed and Mid-South, but go right ahead.
Yeah. And the thing was, though, that the next Omni show, Flair wasn't there. But, I mean, Reed and Ivan Koloff went to a double disqualification. So... Reed and Ivan are now feuding with each other. And, you know, Flair's not there. I'm going through lineups here. Reed and Koloff is pretty much around the horn. All right, next Omni show, Reed beats Koloff.
Yeah, Ivan Koloff was clean. Using the loaded knee pad at that time.
Yes, he was. Yep, and the semifinal match of that show was Abby and Brody to a double count out. Which Bruiser Brody's 1983 Georgia run was pretty fun, too, for that 1 month it lasted.
It definitely was.
Yeah, again, it's just one of his stop-offs. But we get Reed in Russian chain matches with Koloff. But he never has that match with Flair. It's interesting. They do that one match, and then he's gone. His last booking and for Georgia I have... was March 16th, 1983, in Columbus.
Huh.
Him and Paul Orndorff lost to Ivan Koloff and Bob Roop. But he went on to his next big territory, as now he has gone to work for Mid-South Wrestling.
Now, one quick thing, too. This is
yes.
Butch Reed makes a major step forward during that run in Georgia because he is now... appearing on the cover of the After magazines.
Exactly, exactly. And I remember the first After magazine that I wouldn't say I bought because I was basically 4 years old, but the first After magazine that was bought for me, Butch Reed was the centerfold.
PWI, like middle of 83, right?
It would have been early 84.
Okay.
Ish. Hogan was on the cover of the magazine.
All right.
So it would have been early, but it's still early 84 was the date of the magazine. So you know how the After magazines were.
Yes, I did. They were about 6 to 8 weeks behind.
Yeah. So, but yeah, and it talked about this match with Flair and stuff like that. And basically it was talking about how, you know, he's going to come back to Georgia and get his revenge. But, you know, that didn't happen because he went to Mid-South. His first match in Mid-South that I have on record was March the 20th in Tulsa. Again, and he's actually his first match in, teaming with Junkyard Dog, JYD, against Matt Bourne and Hacksaw Duggan. And
Rat Pack.
Matt Bourne. Yeah, the Rat Pack. And people that don't know about the Rat Pack, you got to tell them about that edition of the heel Ted DiBiase.
I don't want to use too many superlatives on this interview that, you know, the best ever, the worst ever. Ted DiBiase is among the best heels I have ever laid eyes on. I love the Million Dollar Man, but Ted DiBiase is a heel in Mid-South. Was as cold and as ruthless as the worst heel you would see in a major motion picture. You would watch this guy and you'd be afraid of him because he'd kill you the way he'd swat a mosquito. And he got Duggan, who was this big, crazy former football guy who would, like, you know, dive through walls if he needed to, and Bourne, who was kind of very underrated guy. Kind of maybe a good, if sort of the he was to that team maybe what Arn Anderson was to the Horsemen.
Yes, that's a solid analogy. Duggan, heel Duggan was, yeah, just basically a maniac, and because he was basically doing, he wasn't ripping off Brody, but he had Brody instincts. He was doing more like a Brody Terry Gordy hybrid. I think it's time period, which makes sense because those are two guys that he was around in Georgia in 81 when he was a young guy.
He was around them in Southwest, too. Or he was around Brody. No, both of them in Southwest.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was around there, too. And then you have, you know, Bourne is like the technician-ish guy who does high spots. And, yeah, I mean, the Rat Pack was really fun in Mid-South. And there's some of that on WWE Network right now. So go check out a couple of their episodes. I think that's up there from the Rat Pack. But Reed's here, and the second night in is the tournament for the North American Heavyweight Title, which was vacated because Stagger Lee left town because JYD was able to come back. Amazing how that works, isn't it?
Amazing coincidence.
So Reed's first match in round one, he beats the Super Destroyer, his old buddy from Georgia. And he advances to the quarterfinals, and he beats Hacksaw Jim Duggan. So that's two good wins for Reed, but loses in the semifinals to the man who's about to turn heel, Mr. Olympia. And I love me some Jerry Stubbs. And I've talked about Jerry Stubbs ad nauseum on the series of Continental podcasts I do with Bo James. But if you haven't seen Jerry Stubbs in Mid-South, that's another disservice you're doing, because babyface, heel, Mr. Olympia Jerry Stubbs was a hell of a performer.
I agree with you, and it's funny, we just got done talking about Skip Young and how that mask was his charisma. No one personified that more, in my opinion, than Jerry Stubbs. I thought he needed the mask. I am a big fan of Jerry Stubbs / Mr. Olympia, but I honestly think putting the North American title on him, which was the number one title in that territory, they didn't even use the NWA title, was a bit of a reach. I thought he was a little bit small, and he just, you know, I didn't think he was in that top shelf with guys like JYD, Reed, DiBiase, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, he may not have been ready for the North American title, but that was the only singles title they they ditched their state titles.
Yep.
You know, he was a state champion. He had been Mississippi champion, and I think he may have held the Louisiana title, but they ditched their state belts. They didn't have the TV title yet. So yeah, and I kind of wanted to, you know, to give him this, you know, big push. So, you know, I guess that's the way it went. You know, give him the North America title. And yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Just my opinion, sure. You know, it's not disrespecting the guy. I just thought those shoes were a little too big for his feet.
Oh no, I mean, I totally get what you're saying. Now, so Reed's here, and Reed's, you know, working on the major guys. He's teaming with JYD on occasion. King Kong Bundy's here, so he's working against him and does a job for Bundy on television on the May 25th tapings. But the real deal with Butch Reed happens, I want to say in June. They do this deal, or yeah, either late May or early June.
June sounds right.
They do this deal where the fans pick from Babyfaces to be JYD's new tag partner. And Hacksaw Duggan had turned Babyface, leaving the Rat Pack because Scandal at Bar. He didn't want to be associated with At Bar, blah, 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 blah. And the fans voted for Duggan over Butch Reed. And Butch was not happy with that at all.
Now, it was actually, if I recall correctly, it was Butch Reed and a couple of other guys. I want to say Magnum TA was out there, and I forget.
Johnny Rich, I think, was one of them, too.
Well, that must have been close. Johnny Rich or...
Yeah, Johnny Rich was one of those guys. But anyway, they do the deal where Reed gets jealous. That's the show that, all right, that's the same show to Bundy. He loses to Bundy. So he loses that, then Bundy pins him.
Yep.
So then Reed turns heel, and his first heel run, and he's just reborn here. He starts working against JYD because he turns on him. He does, he works against Mr. Wrestling too, and he's just killing dudes. He had one squash match with Tim Horner, and this clip was on the Mid-South Wrestling opening for quite a few years. The shoulder block, wasn't it, or the backdrop?
It was a shoulder block, and Horner sold it like he had been, you know, nailed with a shotgun blast.
Yes.
But you know what? Can we talk about Reed's turn for a minute? Because this is beautiful in its simplicity. Reed gets on television, and his pride gets wounded not once but twice. He gets turned down as a tag team partner, and then he gets pinned clean by King Kong Bundy. I think we can all relate to that. You know, pride wounded continuously. And then they tell the simple story. Reed says, I want to be number one, and that's it. How simple does it get? I want to be number one. Junkyard Dog, thank you for taking care of me. Thank you for letting me stay with you. Thank you for, you know, sharing your dining table with me. And screw you. I want to be number one. Beautiful.
Yeah. Exactly. And, it wasn't, you know, a real heavy angle that did it. He wanted to be the top guy, like you said.
Yeah, and he didn't care about friends. He didn't care about morals. He just wanted to be number one, and it's something anyone can understand. And that guy's the bad guy.
Yeah, because he was against, you know, JYD.
And not just because he was against JYD, although that's a big part of it. It's because, you know, he just was so cold about stabbing him in the back. Like, this is what I want, and I don't care about anything else.
Yeah. And like I say, he's going through June and then July, and he's building up the steam of what's about to come. But July 15th, he's in St. Louis. Reed's doing shots for the St. Louis office and their competition against Larry Madison. And they have a Missouri heavyweight title tournament. And Reed's one of the guys in the tournament. Reed wins his first round match over Baron Von Raschke. Then he goes to the quarterfinals and beats Jesse the Body Ventura. Those are two interesting opponents for him.
Never knew Jesse worked St. Louis.
Yeah, Jesse. They brought Jesse. Well, this is, you know, at this time they were bringing in AWA guys because Vern had a piece of the office.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
And yeah, and another quarterfinal match on that show too. Crusher Blackwell and Hulk Hogan to a no contest. But in the semis, Ric Flair with Butch Reed. So Flair gets to beat Butch, and of course Rick beat David Von Erich to become the Missouri Heavyweight Champion because Flair went world champion at this time. Harley was. But all that's all right, because the next night at the Superdome on July 16th, he beats JYD to win the North American Heavyweight title in a match that features Butch Reed's old buddy, Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer, who comes down and helps Butch win the match. And that was interesting, because Reed and Sawyer was, you know, big time angle. It's a 2 out of 3 falls match. You know, and it's just interesting that Butch and Buzz was working together, that, you know, without really a whole lot of explanation.
That was something that I never really liked about one of my pet peeves about wrestling back in the day. If you turned heel or if you turned babyface, but let's say you were a heel and you turned babyface, all of a sudden, all the horrible things you did to the babyface locker room have been magically forgotten and forgiven. And it works the same way. Well, Butch is a heel now. Well, we forget about everything that happened between me and Buzz.
Yeah, I mean, it's convenient how that worked out, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I forgive you. Although we have seen it in wrestling, though, at times where guys wouldn't trust guys that turned.
Yeah, they did it occasionally.
Those are fun angles.
Yeah.
So Reed's a North American champion, and he's defending the belt against all kinds of competitors. JYD, Tommy Rich is coming in doing shots. He's beating him. He's beating Duggan, Mr. Wrestling 2. So he's, you know, going over some top guys. And also this time period, a new guy comes into the territory, and he starts tagging with him a little bit, but it really doesn't become a regular tag team yet. Jim the Anvil Neidhart.
Yeah, as a matter
and
of fact.
And for those of you that, was that?
I do remember that. Believe it or not, Neidhart at this point looked like, to me at least, had the look of a major star, which never really, really happened. But
yeah, it's interesting. If you've never seen Neidhart in Mid-South or in Memphis, then you've seen a totally different Neidhart than you see WBF. He's got, looks like he has more charisma. He's just a different character in a way.
Yeah, he put on a lot of weight in the WWF. I remember him in Mid-South, me looking at him and saying, here's a guy who could come up and headline Madison Square Garden against Backlund.
Yeah, I mean, he was built. He had that body of, you know, that shot put style body, you know, that he was doing. I mean, he was a real thick dude, and it was interesting to watch them team. But that's not really, you know, what's going on at the moment. As Reed's still North American champion, that changes October 12th at the Irish Middle Boy Club, as Magnum TA beats Butch Reed to win the North American title with Junkyard Dog as special referee. Interesting that JYD was referee. And what are your thoughts about Magnum TA's early run in Mid-South and Reed losing to him?
I'm sorry, what did I think about that?
Yeah.
Well, very rarely am I critical of Bill Watts as a booker, but when you look at that whole situation, we go back to, you know, Reed's turn was so simple, it was beautiful. That whole situation with the North American title, with Volkoff getting involved, it was like, you know, you needed a PhD to understand what was going on. So I wasn't a big fan of that. Although at the time, you know, we've talked about this before, Magnum TA was out there. When he was in Florida, to me, he looked like just another guy. But Mid-South, he was looking like a future star.
what was more convoluted? The North American title situation here, or the national heavyweight title situation in Georgia for about 3 months with Larry Zbyszko?
You know what? I think one was a classic case of Watts overthinking something, and the other was a classic case of Ole underthinking something. Bob Geigel shows up, what, 6-7 weeks after Zbyszko buys the title and strips it from him? What are these people doing?
And this was a time period, and we're going to get off track here. This is a time period where, at this point, all of the titles were vacated.
Yes. The Samoans
disappeared. There were no champions.
And they were building up Matt Bourne and Arn Anderson to win the national titles, but they couldn't just put them on the titles on them, I guess, and then Bourne ran into his problem. So, yeah, they didn't have tag team champions for like 5-6 months.
The national TV title was in mothballs. So, yeah. Oh.
Now, I mentioned before, quality control was just out the window in Georgia at this point.
Yeah, and yeah, definitely. And Mid-South, you know, they were pretty good about that, but this is one of those situations that it wasn't. Now, on that same set of tapings, or the same television show, Neidhart and Reed defeat Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Magnum TA to become the new Mid-South Tag Team Champion.
Yes.
So Reed somewhat saves face. And the Neidhart Reed team was pretty fun. They had that football dynamic. I dug them. I dug them for the short time they lasted. It was a good, fun, short-lived tag team.
Agreed 100%. They had good chemistry together. I don't think it would have lasted forever, and it came off really well.
And then we have Bill Watts eventually reinstates Butch Reed as North American Heavyweight Champion, and because of the controversy around TA's win. And they do the deal where Butch Reed wrestles JYD, where Dusty Rhodes is the special referee.
Uh-huh.
And he stops Neidhart's interference, and JYD wins the North American title. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, once again, I think this was just Bill overthinking things a little bit.
Yeah. Now, a very interesting match takes place on that October 20th. That's the same one TV taping. The show that aired the next week. You got Duggan and Dusty against Neidhart and Reed for the tag titles. And Duggan and Dusty win by DQ when Nikolai Volkoff comes out and pile drives Dusty Rhodes on the cement floor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal. You know, because there and what was interesting about this time period was what was that movie that was on television?
The Day After.
And there was multiple territories that were playing off of that TV movie. We're doing the sack of wheat gimmick. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Memphis did it, and Mid-South did it too. And they're playing off of that day, the day after.
Well, if I could just throw this in, because you're a little bit younger, I'm sure you weren't around for this. I went to that aired on a Sunday night. And I went to school on Monday. That movie had everyone in a foul mood, and I am not exaggerating. Everyone was impacted. Everyone was scared by the movie. We just had a deal where the USSR like blew up one of our planes, and then with a commercial flight with about 300 people on it, and then that movie came out. So the mood was not very good.
Yeah, I was 4, so I don't remember it, but. If you go to YouTube, you will see like different videos from that era of like people having to explain to people about, the movie, this is not real. I mean, it was kind of like that. You remember the old stories about War of the Worlds or Orson Welles, where people were thinking that we're really being invaded by aliens.
You know what?
That's what this was kind of like.
There was, I think, genuine concern that we were on the brink of a nuclear war, especially given Russia's or the USSR's conduct in the real world. Obviously, that movie, it was almost like, well, here's what could happen, and it really could have happened.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, But Volkov didn't get over anyway, but anyway.
Oh, no, because, yeah, Nikolai Volkov. So, Reed Neidhart's the top tag team in the territory. But Reed's still doing matches against JYD. He loses a loser gets painted yellow match in New Orleans on November 19th for the North American title. Him and JYD are having ghetto street fights in Houston. But Reed makes a return to Georgia. A one-night return on Thanksgiving night, 1983.
Oh, that's right.
Of course, that night was Starrcade, so a lot of your heavy hitters was in Greensboro. But Thanksgiving was a traditional strong show for Georgia Championship Wrestling. And they had their annual tag team tournament at the Omni for $50,000. Listen to these tag teams that was in this tournament. Jim Neidhart and King Kong Bundy over Tommy Rogers and Joe Lightfoot. Butch Reed and Pistol Pez Watley over Ravishing Randy Rose and a guy named Jimmy Randolph, who I really don't know who that was. Do you even know who Jimmy Randolph was? That was one of these mysteries to me, who he was.
I think he was a Georgia TV guy. I could be wrong on that.
All right. We had the Bruise Brothers, Pork Chop Cash, and the Dream Machine over Nikolai Volkov and Crusher Khrushchev, or Crusher Darzo. Ron Garvin and Hacksaw Jim Duggan. That's a team. Over Bob Brown, not Bulldog Bob Brown, but Bald Georgia Jobber Bob Brown, who would become a member of the Hunters with Dale Veazey, and the Golden Boy, Chick Donovan. And then this tag team is going to get you if you've never heard of this one before.
Oh, I remember watching this on TV, being blown away by it, but go ahead.
Macho Man Randy Savage and Magnum T.A. over the Mad Mongolians. Macho Man Randy Savage and Magnum T.A. as a tag team. That's amazing.
It really is. Course, and Savage was not a star at all at this point, but I recognized a lot of the names that they were bringing in from the magazines and being like, you know, wow, Randy Savage, Magnum T.A., the Bruise Brothers, etc.
Well, this is Savage's first major territory appearance after ICW. Because he starts Memphis up the next week.
He had wrestled in Georgia and Mid-Atlantic, like at the on the lower card.
Before ICW. I'm talking about after ICW.
Okay, yeah.
After he had, you know, been basically blackballed for years. Yeah, here he is, Thanksgiving night at the Omni, and then shows up in Memphis the week or two later and begins that great run there. But and Ronnie Garman's booking at this time, so that's probably why.
Okay.
Think about this. All right, here's a what if. What if Savage becomes a main guy in Georgia in this era right here as like a babyface? How do you think it goes for Georgia?
I think Randy Savage is the kind of guy, he has to be a heel first, but he's the kind of heel, as we saw, that you can, you know, once he's had that heel run, it transitions quite well into a baby face. But I mean, I'm sure you've seen his Memphis stuff. He was scary.
Absolutely.
You think this guy came across as legitimately out of his mind. So I think it would have been great.
Yeah. And if you do have him as a baby face, you just brought in Ted DiBiase as your heel. You could have Savage DiBiase as your top program in 1984.
Yeah. And DiBiase was still at the top of his game.
Much better than Mr. R and Ted DiBiase at 1984, that's a fact. But anyway, Reed and Watley beat Neidhart and Bundy. The Bruise Brothers beat Garvin and Duggan. And then you have Savage and T.A. over the Bruise Brothers. And Reed and Watley beat Savage and T.A. to win the money. So there you go. Butch Reed and a $50,000, well, $25,000 richer, I guess. He split the money with Watley. Of course, they never got that money. But, interesting.
Maybe over the course of 2 or 3 years in Georgia, but.
Yeah. Now, in back to Mid-South, Reed Neidhart have started the feud up with Magnum T.A. and his teacher, Mr. Wrestling 2. And this dynamic here is so great. If you've never seen the Magnum T.A. Mr. Wrestling 2 angle, the full genesis of the angle, you're missing some of the best storytelling in wrestling in that era. And tell everybody about that, John.
Well, I've used the word greatest too many times in this darn interview already, but I thought it was the greatest feud and storyline of all time. You know, Mr. Wrestling 2 takes T.A. under his wing as a protege, makes him a much better wrestler, brings him to the top, and then when T.A. finally gets there, old man Mr. Wrestling 2 becomes very bitter and very jealous. Magnum T.A. shows himself as being extremely loyal, despite, you know, Mr. Wrestling 2 slapping him on the face on TV for no real reason, that sort of thing. And in the end, they feud, two cheats to win the North American title, and two takes on another protege, Mr. Wrestling 2. Now, Mr. Wrestling is Mr. Wrestling 1, another Bill Watts is thinking too much kind of thing, but it was good. And at the end, Mr. Wrestling 2 showed Mr. Wrestling 1 exactly no loyalty, which Magnum TA had showed him. So it's phenomenal. You must see it.
Yeah, and like the training videos where they're Mr. Wrestling 2 is teaching Magnum how to do the $1 million knee lift and all this great stuff, man. It's fantastic. Like I said, it's on YouTube, I'm pretty sure, so it's a must-see stuff.
And young Jim Cornette as an antagonist, and the perfect antagonist, may I add, for this whole situation.
Oh, absolutely, because 2 and TA win the Mid-South Tag Titles in a steel cage match in New Orleans on Christmas night. And Neidhart costs, you know, Reed the team the match, and Reed blames him. So that starts off their feud. And they start having football helmet matches around the horn and stuff like that. And I thought the football helmet matches were interesting gimmicks. You didn't see a whole lot of that going on in that era. It was a rare one. Although Mid-South would use it a decent amount in 84, but this was like the first time that they used it.
No, yeah, you have to be right, because I remember the Steve Williams stuff hadn't started yet. Quick dash on Reed and Neidhart. They had an argument in the locker room that started all of it, that turned into a fight. It looked like two football players in a locker room arguing and then getting into a fight. Like, I mean, I've seen this, and that's what it looks like. So, good job on their part. Then they have the football helmet match. It's Neidhart who gets the football helmet on top of the pole, and then Butch Reed pulls out powder and blinds him, which I thought was hilarious. It's like, yeah, you've got but boom, I've got something better.
Yeah. So we go to 1984, and Reed's free of Neidhart, and he casually takes up this other tag partner, a young blonde-haired fellow known as Nature Boy Buddy Landell. And this, if I had been a wrestling promoter booker in that era and I saw this, I'm bringing Butch Reed and Buddy Landell in as a package act in any territory around the country and watching them go crazy, because this gimmick here was so good. I think Watts did a really good job with them, but I think he could have done a lot more with them. But you got to describe the Butch Reed Buddy Landell dynamic.
It was amazing. It was Butch Reed, this hard, you know, dude who was obviously tougher than nails, teaming up with Buddy Landell. If Buddy Landell was a stock in 1984, I would have put all my money into this guy. He looked like he was going to be everything, and didn't exactly turn out that way, which is unfortunate. But he was, I mean, no one was sneakier and more conniving than little Buddy Landell, and then he gets to hide behind Butch Reed. It was, you know, an outstanding dynamic.
And they raised hell on Junkyard Dog. I mean, they made Junkyard Dog's life hell. And one of my favorite things of this time period right here was they took it around. It wasn't just Mid-South they did this. They did it in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And the best part about it was, you know, Landell's there with his Memphis cachet. And JYD's in Memphis, and Landell comes out there and gets in his face. And then Reed comes out there, sneak attacks him, and they paint him yellow live on Memphis television. We have Lance Russell being Lance Russell, awesome.
Yep.
Oh, come on, buddy. You know, oh, what? I mean, that's creative stuff. That's great stuff right there.
Good night, buddy. Get out of here with that.
Oh, come on, buddy. And they did it. They did it. See, well, see, they already painted him yellow himself.
You know, it was almost like they paint. I mean, I know it was a coincidence, but it was like it was almost like they were booking JYD knowing he was going to go to the WWF and that they were going to bury him.
I don't think here's the deal here. I mean, I think they knew he was leaving, but remember at this time period, JYD was working a lot of shots for Crockett.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to Georgia. He was doing some stuff in Florida.
World class.
So he definitely was going around. I think maybe they were treating him like, they were thinking maybe he was going to be like, say what Dusty was in Florida. Where, you know, yeah, this is his home base, but he's going to travel around as well. He's going to be more of a part-time guy in the territory. And yeah, that was pretty smart on their part to show the weakness there and get people over on him. Although in the end, you know, when they did that whole deal of Mr. Wrestling 2, the title change, I mean, a lot of people tell you that's what killed New Orleans.
I've heard that.
You know, that whole deal with the loaded knee and stuff like that.
Well, JYD more or less getting pinned clean in the middle by Mr. Wrestling 2, I have heard hurt their business.
Yeah. So, so you got painted yellow, and also the great tar and feathering. That's what happened in Memphis. He got tar and feathered,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, that's a classic Memphis staple. And that's something that's kind of missing in wrestling today, isn't it? Stuff like tar and feathering and painted yellow. I mean, that's old school tropes that you don't see around anymore.
No, you don't. And, you know, outside of Memphis and Mid-South, I can't think of any promoter. Well, painted yellow went around, but like the tar and feathering outside of Memphis and Mid-South, I can't think of anyone doing it. I could be wrong.
Yeah. And, Ernie Ladd is back and he's involved in this. And Landell's like his lackey too, in a way.
Yeah.
It's funny watching Landell, you know, being like the mouthy little guy with these big giants watching his back.
Yeah, and supposedly that got everyone over big. It got Landell over for being this little wimp, and it got Ladd and Reed over for allowing it.
Yes. And they did that thing. They injured Sonny King. This is the era of Butch Reed, when Butch Reed was just a monster. And there was a great skit where Butch Reed is Buddy Landell is going to show everybody what he has taught Butch Reed in the gym. So he's got the camera crew there. He's telling him, like, yeah, I'm going to show y'all, you know, what I've been teaching Butch and this, that, and the other. And he would always, when he go to Butch, he's like, Butch, put that extra weight on the bars like I told you. You know, he would sneak that in or try to sit where Butch wouldn't hear him. And Butch called him the one time. He's like, well, you know what I mean, Butch. But the best thing is Buddy's doing this, and Buddy's sitting there drinking, like, water and taking all the credit for everything that Butch was doing.
Yeah, Butch Reed was an absolute monster in the gym. He's got, you know, a full sweat going on, and Buddy's like, yeah, I'm responsible for all this.
Just classic Buddy Landell, man. That's classic Buddy Landell. I love it. And then they have another guy comes in. Named Brickhouse Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a classic Buddy moment. They do a deal where him and Buddy have a arm wrestling match. I think more than one, right? Wasn't it like two or three?
I think it was two.
Brick beat him every time. And they didn't do a wrestling match, and Brick beats him there too. And then, of course, Reed gets involved as well, eventually beats up on Brickhouse, but yeah, this great stuff on that.
You know, one quick thing
but also,
I wanted to say, too, like regarding Mid-South, the WWF, rightfully, at this era, was getting a lot of flack for the wrestlers using steroids. But you go back and look at Mid-South in 1984, I mean, some of these guys look like they're about to explode, namely Buddy Landell.
Hercules.
Yeah, especially Hercules, and Reed, too. But Buddy Landell was huge during that era. And, you know, people say, oh, no, he wasn't. Go back and look. Buddy looks like, you know, he looks like the Michelin Man.
Yeah, and Hercules in promos bragging about what he's taking.
Yep, I take
he's
pills
mentioning
bigger
steroids
than Rick
by
Morton.
Name. Was that?
He said he took pills bigger than Ricky Morton.
Yes! It's crazy. And Dr. Death was kind of transitioning his physique here, too.
Oh, that's right.
So he's getting leaner, not as fat. And, you know, Duggan's a big dude. I mean, and Magnum. I mean, there was a lot of guys there that were...
that looked enhanced.
Were definitely... Yeah, the pharmacy was in effect, no doubt.
Yeah. But, I mean, what are you going to do? That's the wrestling business. It's what the fans want to see. It's how you get over.
Yeah. Now, August saw JYD leave the territory. And, you know, we talked about how Ole reacted when the Samoans left. I don't think any promoter reacted like Bill Watts did when Junkyard Dog left.
No, and this is why I always thought I think we'd be living in a different wrestling world if it were Bill Watts that got the WTBS contract in 1985 instead of Crockett, because Watts was a fighter. When, you know, his number one guy for close to 5 years got up and left and went to the competition and knew he was going to be coming to New Orleans on WWF shows, he made sure it wasn't going to be pleasant for anybody.
But the problem was that Watts was always trying to find his replacement. And the first guy he brought in to be that guy was Master G, George Wells. And the angle they did was kind of a cute angle where George Wells comes out there and says that he had turned down a booking at Madison Square Garden that night.
$5,000.
You know, $5,000 to come to Mid-South. And he beats Hacksaw Butch Reed with that cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget Jim Ross on commentary. He's like, we got a stallion in here, you know, Master G. Look at that stallion go.
Oh, dear.
And they put Master G over Butch Reed in all the major towns and in ghetto street fights and, you know, different types of matches. And the thing about Master G was, I mean, he had a good look, but he could not talk to save his life. And the fans saw through it, and they just weren't into him.
I think you said you hit right on the head when you said the fans saw through it. That DiBiase put that clown over on TV clean. You know, it's just I hated that.
Yes.
And I think it was just, you know, I don't know what Watts saw in George Wells, other than the color of his skin. He didn't have a physique. He had a belly. He couldn't talk. He couldn't work. What else is there?
Yeah, I mean, it was because he was black. He was looking for a black star. And Master G wasn't that guy.
Yeah, he had the guy right under his nose, but I guess he wanted to try Master G first.
Well, he'll try him in a little bit. But here's a cool little appearance. You know, Mid-South and World Class were working together loosely at this time period. World Class would have guys work the Oklahoma City shows and Tulsa shows, and Mid-South was sometimes, you know, their guys would come in and work Fort Worth or Dallas. More often not Fort Worth, because Dallas is on Friday, so they work in Bosch. But since Fort Worth was on Mondays, if they weren't running New Orleans or whatever, they wouldn't have their guys come in. Well, Butch Reed made an appearance on the Labor Day show in 84. Mm-hmm. He had an arm wrestling match with Kerry Von Erich.
I did not know that.
They went to a DQ. Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit ahead. No, I guess we're not. We're in 84. No, we're...
Yeah.
Okay, but I had heard that Reed was supposed to get a push in World Class. He was supposed to work there full time, and something happened between him and Fritz and it fell apart.
Yes. And yeah, which that happened with Magnum TA too. Magnum was supposed to go to Dallas and be the next in line behind the Von Erichs. And then he went to Crockett instead.
I think he made the right move.
Yeah, he made the right move.
Yeah, to say the least. Yeah.
I'll say.
I don't know if you knew this, not to get too far off track, but Magnum TA got what would have been Barry Windham's push in the Carolinas.
Yes, because Barry Windham left to go to WWF. Yeah.
But yeah, like Barry was going to get the put, you know, the big push with the U.S. title and the win over Wahoo, etc.
Exactly. Yep, that was what was building. Now Butch Reed made another appearance outside of Mid-South in this time period on September 18th, 1984, at the first taping of Pro Wrestling USA at the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, Tennessee, teaming up with Tony Atlas. And they went over Keith Roberson and Kurt Von Hess, and they went over the Dirty White Boys on that TV taping. But Pro Wrestling USA, what a train wreck that turned out to be, didn't it, huh? Oh, my God.
I remember watching that. It had been advertised in Pro Wrestling, in the After magazines. I had heard about it. I was looking forward to seeing it. And it was on WPIX New York, which, you know, we got on cable. And literally, as soon as the music started playing, I'm like, oh, God, this is going to be terrible. It was just the worst production. And you could just sense that it was going to be a train wreck, and it was.
Yeah, and Lance Russell was like the ring announcer, but they had Jack Reynolds doing the announcing proper, and no. No.
Best part about that was as soon as Vince laid eyes on that tape, he just hired Jack Reynolds. He appeared on WWF TV almost right away, and it was hysterical. It was just Vince showing a message.
It's total Vince, you know, taking guys. It didn't matter. He didn't care.
Nope.
It's just you couldn't have them. I'm going to take them. You know, just classic Vince. Well, Butch Reed had another arm wrestling match with Kerry Von Erich at the Cotton Bowl on October 27th on that big show, where Kerry beat him this time, and he also worked Iceman Parsons. Iceman King Parsons in a match that went to a draw.
Yeah.
So, and I remember that aired on television.
Yeah, I did see that on TV, and it was one of those things. I mean, you know, Reed had so much more talent than Parsons, but I get it. You know, Reed's just there for the day, and that's where Iceman, you know, Iceman's still a big star there. So I think a draw makes sense in that situation.
And one more quick appearance here from Reed in World Class. On November 19th, he does the job for Terry Gordy in Fort Worth at the Will Rogers Coliseum.
Well, I did not know about that match.
Which sounds like a hell of a match, but what's going on in Mid-South in November, though, is a brand new Butch Reed. Buddy Landale shows up one day on television with this brand new Rolex watch. He's got money, and he's made a deal with Scandor Akbar. And he's being cryptic about it, saying that Akbar says, you're going to deliver him? And Buddy's like, yeah, he'll be here next week, blah, blah, blah. And they have a big press conference in the ring, where Jim Cornette, who's wearing a mask because he had his head shaved, is in the ring, and he has sold the rights of Hercules Hernandez, who was his bodyguard, to Scandor Akbar, and he's now Sheik Hercules Hernandez. And Ted DiBiase's there, and they're going to be the new tag team. And Buddy Landale's up there, and Butch Reed's in the ring as well. And Akbar asked Landale if the deal was done, and Buddy's like, yeah, it's done. And they do the deal, and Reed's like, who are you? You know, you don't own me, and whatever like that. And he's like, I ain't worth this sucker either. And it ends up being DiBiase, Hercules, and Landale just beating up on Butch Reed. And that was the Butch Reed babyface turn.
Yeah.
And, of course, he had beat Master G. He got his revenge on Master G around the horn, like right before this angle was taped. So they got him to get his heat back. And they turned him babyface, which killed Master G dead in the water. And now Butch Reed is the guy that they're going to try to use to replace the Junkyard Dog. What did you think about this whole angle and the prospects of Butch Reed as the babyface?
Well, quick thought on the Buddy Landell thing. He's out there wearing a Rolex watch, and Skandor is like, "What are you doing? That's not for you." And Buddy's like, I'm just taking care of it for you, Mr. Akbar. Don't worry about it." And he's such a weasel. It was great. Skandor Akbar, who I have never been a huge fan of, but I thought he was very effective on this day because Butch Reed, Buddy Landell is like, "Here, Butch, you get this watch if you join Skandor Akbar," and Reed takes the watch, this Rolex watch apparently, and slams it down the mat and stomps on it, and Buddy's, you know, going crazy, crawling around trying to put it back together. And Skandor Akbar, I thought, did one of his most effective interviews of his career. He's like, "I should have come directly to you, Butch, but I need you to understand something. I'm taking over, and you're either with us or against us. What's it going to be?" And Reed stood right up to him. But I thought that was a great line. And it just explained, you know, like, okay, this is the new heel faction, and Butch Reed is now the new Superman babyface.
And Duggan makes a save.
Yep.
And then you get this great meeting at the desk where they, you know, form their bond as the Hacksaw.
Uh-huh.
Which was, you know, solid stuff. And they do a Butch and Buddy match after that. And this is when we get Dr. Death Steve Williams showing up in his football gear in full Oklahoma.
Yep.
I mean, full uniform, everything. And just beats Reed's ass. And this is when Mid-South is really... I mean, Mid-South in most of early 84 was pretty much rock and roll, midnight heavy. You know, rock and rolls are still there. Midnights are about to leave. But you're kind of getting more emphasis on the singles stuff and DiBiase. And it's this whole new dynamic of heels that's compared to what you just came from. I mean, which version of Mid-South were you preferring? Did you prefer that early part of 84 with the Rock and Rolls Midnights dominating the scene, or the DiBiase at bar dynamic with Reed, Duggan, etc.?
I personally, they're both phenomenal. I would go with the early one because Jim Cornette was just phenomenal in that role. I mean, he was so despicable. I mean, he'd go out there and he'd make fun of Boyd Pierce's suits, and he'd make poor Boyd Pierce feel bad. I mean, that's a heel right there.
Yeah.
But you have the Magnum Wrestling 2 angle, and you've got Cornette, and I DiBiase wasn't around. But yeah, just by, you know, photo finish, but I would go with the first half of 84.
They're all equally great. As well. I mean, it was good that it was different, though. They needed to go to a different direction, you know, from what they were just doing. So that's how good promotions do.
It was also a Watts thing, because he had lost JYD, and even before that, crowds were down. And I think a lot of wrestling promoters, you go with A, what you know, and B, who you are, and what Watts is and knows is being a big guy. And he went right back to the big guys when, you know, things weren't going as well as at the box office as he would have liked.
And Dundee was still there, and Dundee was still, you know, pushing his style of wrestling as well. So you had like a hybrid going on here of a Watts and a Dundee style of philosophies
mm-hmm.
mixing in together, which was really good.
Yeah, definitely.
And speaking of big men, Butch Reed has a TV match with Ernie Ladd. Buddy Landell runs out. Reed takes care of him. Reed's beating up both Landell and Ernie Ladd. When Kamala makes his return to Mid-South,
yes.
And he just squashes Reed, and this is the big feud for Reed now, Kamala, and we get Reed painting himself up,
yep.
Pest Kamala. And what did you think about the Reed-Kamala stuff?
I mean, they had Kamala built up as a monster in the territory, so why not? He's the perfect guy to kind of feed Butch Reed as the first heel he's taking on in his new babyface role.
Yeah, it makes absolute sense. I mean, it's a big deal to have Kamala back in, because Kamala had been, he had just left WWF, where he had been feuding with Andre.
That's right.
And he's coming to Mid-South. And I say he'd been all over, WWF television, which they acknowledged. And, he took care of Butch Reed here, but of course Butch Reed would get his in the end, and what's another funny thing about this time period, to show you how my wants was they would show current guys in WWF that had worked matches in either Houston or worked for Mid-South proper. And one of the matches they loved to show at this time period was Butch Reed beating the Iron Sheik in Houston. And I remember they pushed it like it was a match that had just happened. When it was a match that happened, over a year and a half earlier.
They did the same thing with Ted DiBiase and Tito Santana.
Yep.
And they did it with, later on, they did it with Williams and Bundy when Watts referred to Bundy as an overweight pachyderm. See, that's the thing with Watts. He was a fighter. I think he would have been the guy to go to match up against McMahon. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. Let me backtrack a little bit. We were talking about the interview at the desk with the Hacksaws. First coming together, Duggan had just saved Reed. That was the moment where I looked at Butch Reed. I didn't see it until 87. But I looked at that, and I'm like, this guy is about to be one of the elite superstars in the business, like top three. Like, it looked like he was on the launching pad, ready to go out, into outer space.
Yeah. I mean, you see him here, and he's now babyface, and he had been already an awesome heel, so now he really hasn't changed a lot of his style. He's just a babyface now, kind of like Duggan.
Yeah.
Duggan was the same way.
Dusty Rhodes 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
Roddy Piper 3 years later, 2 years later, yeah.
Yeah. So, Piper and before, 2 years earlier, too, in Georgia.
Georgia and Mid-Atlantic. He was the same guy.
Same guy. So, you got the Reed-Kamala feud, and Reed gets wins in that regard. Iceman Parsons comes back in, so they're bringing in, more different black guys to try to appeal to that dynamic of JYD left. But there's another guy that comes in. John Nord has the Barbarian, and John Nord had worked in AWA as himself, and this was his first push, his first big territory, and he's immediately programmed with Butch Reed, and they have a match. I can't remember where exactly, maybe in Tulsa, and he potatoed Reed very hard, and Reed had a very bad swollen eye. Which, of course, Mid-South, in their infinite genius, decided to take advantage of. So they had Jim Ross interview Butch Reed with this bad-looking eye to prove that wrestling is indeed real. What do you think about when Mid-South did stuff like that?
I thought it was great. This is right around the time they had the potato video of, guys getting Bobby Eaton hitting Bobby Fulton in the head with a chair, and it sounded like a shotgun went off. I think more than showing that wrestling was quote unquote real, it was almost like, this is the hard hitting wrestling, not the goofy wrestling that's on the other channel. But if I may, I heard a different story about Reed versus Nord, and I heard it from Dave Meltzer.
Okay.
That they got into a locker room fight, and that's where the black eye came from.
Oh, well, there we go.
Yeah. Watts was egging them on, and finally they got into it, and Nord got a good shot in on him. That's where it came from.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Now, Reed. All right, let's see here. Reed is working with Nord, and then he's put Nord over. So they're trying to build the Barbarian huge, but there's another reason too. Reed leaves the territory.
Yep.
And he goes to a place that would be very unlikely for Butch Reed to be, the AWA. And that was a fish out of water. I mean, he didn't last long there. But it was just weird seeing Butch Reed in the AWA. How much of that have you seen?
A little bit. And back then, you know, I mean, the AWA, I'm trying to figure out, were they on cable yet? Were they on ESPN yet? Or is that about to happen?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah, they weren't there yet. It's coming. It's in the summer.
Yeah, for a long time, Butch Reed leaving Mid-South when he did was, to me, just one of the greatest mysteries of all time. How does this guy leave Mid-South, wind up in the AWA for a cup of coffee, and then wind up going back to, of all places, Central States? It would be literally, to me, it would be like, I don't want to say Hulk Hogan going to Central States, but Hulk Hogan leaving the WWF for a far less attractive gig.
Yeah, and then you have what the deal is here is when Reed leaves, Terry Taylor replaces him in the hierarchy. And the story goes that the reason why Terry Taylor got such a big push in Mid-South is because Bill Watts' daughter had a crush on
him. I'd never heard that before. That's awesome.
Yeah. So Reed leaves, and Taylor, who was already the Mid-South TV champion, gets to beat DiBiase. And is both double champion. You know, and Terry Taylor was a solid hand, but I don't know about that one. I mean, Reed should have been the guy to get that belt, or somebody like that. Maybe even Duggan. I mean, that's the type of guy that should be the North American champion. Taylor, I just think he wasn't the right fit for that title. What did you think about that?
We are in respectful disagreement. I bought it at the time. This was when they were on WTBS. And yes. DiBiase comes out and says, hey, now that we're on WTBS, that television title means a lot more. I want it. And I totally bought Terry Taylor's North American champion. I know not everyone is, but I think if you saw Terry Taylor prior to his Red Rooster deal in the WWF, I saw a guy who was a major, major talent.
He was.
We talked about a little bit earlier about like Mr. Olympia. I thought the shoes of North American champion were too big for his feet. Terry Taylor, I totally bought as North American champion at the time.
Yeah, he kind of was, you know, he dressed the part. I mean, he came out there wearing the suits and stuff like that. He carried himself like a champion, no doubt, but he wasn't the main deal. You know, Duggan was always seen as higher than he was. And that's the thing about that. You know, North American champion, you kind of want him, if he's a babyface, to be like the top guy. And Duggan was always seen as higher as he was. His angles were more important. You know, I mean, I know some shows Terry Taylor was defending the North American title against Lynn Ditt in New Orleans in mid-card matches. I mean, that's tough. Although Brad Armstrong, in all fairness, Brad Armstrong had just been North American champion too. So, and Brad Armstrong was defending against in mid-card matches as well. So it was weird what was going on with the North American title at the time. But yeah, I mean, I understand. And this was the peak of Terry Taylor as a worker. I mean, the peak of his character is coming up later when he turns heel. But as a worker, he was probably at his best in this era. You know, his matches with Flair, etc., you know, other stuff he was doing. But, yeah, it was just interesting. And then Reed, you know, like I said, Reed's in AWA. And here's an interesting Reed match in AWA. At the Rosemont Horizon on April 28th, 85, Dick the Bruiser and the Crusher beats Butch Reed and Larry Zbyszko.
Well, they were over in Chicago, but the Bruiser and the Crusher. You know, and going back a little...
That's a culture shock.
What's that?
That's culture shock, though.
Yeah, I do understand that. I mean, we could go... I'll throw this out there really quick, because this is something you and I could talk about all day. There's that delicate balance, I think, between putting your championship on your top guy, and you say, wow, he doesn't need the belt. But if you keep using your championship just to elevate other wrestlers, that championship becomes less and less valuable. So I always thought promoters really had to watch that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And looking at like more rematches in AWA, Reed at one point was teaming various times with Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts. Whenever Michael Hayes was getting Martel, Butch would team with Gordy and Roberts in six man.
That's right. I'm trying to remember where I got where I was getting that AWA TV from. It must have been on syndication out here, but I don't remember.
Well, it was on Pro Wrestling USA.
He was
working Baron Von Raschke at the Meadowlands on June 22nd, which that show had a match of the Freebirds versus Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Greg Gagne, and Kurt Hennig. What a team that is.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's probably where you saw him, was on Pro Wrestling USA.
Okay, yeah, that had to be it.
So Reed makes his return to Mid-South on June 24th, 1985 in New Orleans. Against Ric Flair.
That's right. That's when they started bringing in Ric Flair.
Yeah. That's Reed's first match back in the promotion. It was an NWA World Heavyweight title match with Ric Flair. And they did a pretty decent job explaining on television how, you know, they had a past history. And Bill Watts thought that Bill Watts' dream was to have the NWA World Heavyweight title change hands in his territory. And in New Orleans, and he thought Reed was the guy to do it. So that was a good way of handling it. But that's a hell of a match, too, by the way, that New Orleans match. That got released on the Universal Wrestling Archives site a while back. And all their New Orleans matches were great. And I'm glad that those came out because, you know, if you watch Power Pro Wrestling, yeah, you saw the match, but you didn't see, like, the full matches. And, yeah, it was good to see, you know, Reed and Flair have that type of match. And, yeah, I mean, you saw what could have been, for sure. Now, Reed's back in and full-time, and he wins the Mid-South television title. Dutch Mantel had beat the Snowman, and we got to talk about him, to becoming the new television champion. Now, after Reed left, the newest guy that they would use to try to replace the Junkyard Dog was a guy named the Snowman, who was Eddie Crawford from Memphis. And boy, was he terrible. John, you got to tell her about the Snowman.
I had heard, I don't want to be libelous, but I heard that nickname didn't come from anything falling out of the sky. I mean, he was apparently he was legit friends with Muhammad Ali. He was able to act as a liaison to get Muhammad Ali booked at the Superdome. I mean, Muhammad Ali is probably, you know, the biggest sports figure in world history. So that's always a plus, although yeah, I did see that turned into a cluster because Jake Roberts wouldn't sell for anybody. He's like, hey, I got to come back here next month. But yeah, Snowman, like I said, he was pretty terrible. We know why he got his push, and he is the originator, or he was part, or the central part of the first real fake shoot that I've ever seen, Memphis 1990. And like everything, fake shoots got done to death, but that was the first one I ever saw.
Yeah, he was a terrible wrestler. Terrible. Yeah. Horrible. They had short matches to try to protect him, but he was just terrible. And the fan, he couldn't go promo to save his life. Horrible promo. And eventually they got tired of his act. And once Ali, they did the Ali thing, the Snowman's push kind of faded away. And that's what we get with Dutch beat him and then Reed beat Dutch. And Reed also got a clean win on Ted DiBiase on television in his comeback as well.
Yeah, I remember that.
When he came back into territory. And that was a big deal because, you know, Reed's getting that push for Flair. Flair's got a bounty on his head. So he's having bounty matches he's having to go through. And they eventually had the big Superdome match on August the 10th, 1985, where Flair beats Reed. And they do a deal now where Flair says that he's not going to defend the NWA World Heavyweight title against anybody but the North American Heavyweight Champion, which at that time period was Captain Redneck Dick Murdoch. And there was a deal where Reed and Murdoch had some issues about that, And Dick Murdoch's having a match with Dr. Death Steve Williams. And at this time, DiBiase is in Japan. So Bob Sweet Tan is in Mid-South as DiBiase's liaison and defending the Mid-South Tag Champ titles with Doc. And Sweet Tan jumps in the ring. Sweet Tan and Doc are beating down Murdoch. Reed refuses to help. And this is one of those really strong Bill Watts angles. This whole deal that ended up between Duggan, Murdoch, and Butch Reed over who was going to face Ric Flair.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all got him.
Yeah, and I always thought that was a very effective angle as far as A, making the World Championship match extremely important, and B, making the North American Championship extremely important. It made, you know, again, that, you know, it's a very simple storyline. You want to be the champion, and then you want to be the North American champion, and then you want to be the world champion.
And we got some hellacious Reed Murdoch matches out of this too that we that we had when we got the Watt stuff, you know, from the house shows. They had some very good matches from New Orleans. And, of course, when a lot of the Houston stuff got out there from the Houston television, Reed Murdoch there, just great matches. And they were still both baby faces because Murdoch hadn't really officially turned yet. And then Reed beats Murdoch for the title on October 14th in New Orleans. And now he's able to get back in where he needs to get that shot with Flair. And then, of course, Murdoch changes the game as he would do his deal with Ted DiBiase. Before we talk about that, Flair is now pissed off that Reed's champion. So he does the old Harley Race deal where he goes into the heel locker room and offers Dick Slater $25,000 to injure Butch Reed. Dick Slater's just in the territory, him and Buzz Sawyer both. And this was, I love this period of Mid-South as well. I thought this was a really fun period. The whole Butch Reed, Dick Slater dynamic feud there involving Dark Journey, which that was kind of a controversial deal at the time, wasn't it? Dark Journey is Dick Slater's manager.
Well, yeah, it was because it was a very attractive black woman, light skinned, very attractive, is putting it mildly. And she was with this white guy, which, I mean, we're talking about a different time and era, but you know, it sometimes that didn't go over too well with, you know, different races dating each other. And it went both ways. I mean, I went to school in New Hampshire and was probably maybe 5% black kids. And, you know, if you, I'm trying to put this gently, I became interested in one of the black girls I went to school with. And I was advised not to date her because the black guys, they've only got so many girls they can date. And if I went out and took one of them, that wouldn't go over very well. So and that's just the world we lived in.
Yes. Yeah. It's just the way it was back then.
Yeah. And I'm sure,
you know, it was different.
You know, there was, I could see a black guy in the crowd being like, you know, Dick, we've got plenty of white women to choose from. Why are you taking one of ours? Come on, man. You know? That's heat.
Exactly. And some of the best television in Mid-South history is coming up now. All right, Butch Reed confronts Dick Slater about this bounty that's on his head and goes in there and turns his back on Slater, daring him to take his best shot at
him.
Slater acts like a complete chicken shit, and he says that he's giving Flair the money back and walks out.
He has already given Flair the money back.
Yes. Well, Flair and Reed have a match. Butch pins Flair clean in the middle. Slater then hits the ring and injures Butch's Reed's neck and now collects the new $50,000 bounty on Butch Reed's head. And this was, and seeing Flair lose on television was a big deal. You know, you didn't see that.
No, you didn't. As a matter of fact, and I remember that pile driver Slater gave Reed. It was almost scary. Like, he, yes. Slater laid into him, and Reed landed like you know, straight down right on his head. It looked like Butch Reed got hurt.
Yeah, it was pretty vicious. Well, that leads into another thing. All right, Reed is supposed to have an NWA World Heavyweight title match on television against Ric Flair. Reed's injured. So they decide to bring in Ted DiBiase as a substitute for the match. Dick Murdoch comes out, demands that DiBiase give that shot to him because he's his mentor. You know, without him, he wouldn't be in wrestling. So Ted DiBiase refuses. Murdoch jumps him, posts him. DiBiase does his hellacious blade job, and DiBiase has to be carried out, and they do some more matches on TV show, but DiBiase refused to not wrestle Flair. He had to wrestle Flair, and they had the match, and DiBiase is bandaged up, but I mean that didn't last long. He's bleeding all over the place, and he tries his best. And this is now lead heel to DiBiase now, folks. He tries his best. He's fighting. The fans are getting behind him. And eventually gets knocked out of the ring, gets counted out. Murdoch comes out, gives him the brainbuster on the floor, fractures his neck, quote unquote, and says that, and eventually it played off that he was going to retire from wrestling. Murdoch gets suspended. It's a way to explain both them going to Japan for tours. But He's an integral part of this in a way because, again, he was supposed to be in the match and DiBiase was, but this is amazing television. No doubt.
It really was. A couple of things. I mean, Ted DiBiase, minus about a six-month hiatus, had been the top heel in Mid-South, or at least, you know, if he wasn't number one, he was number 1A since, I want to say, May 1982. And again, DiBiase was a vicious cutthroat heel with no soul. And they do this angle and in one episode of television make him a hero.
Yes.
The other part of it was, I mean, and Dick Murdoch coming into this, technically, probably more than technically, was babyface. And he comes to the ring and he was so dismissive towards Ted DiBiase. It's like, get out of here. I'm the little guy into wrestling. Take a walk. And DiBiase's like, no, I've been waiting a long time for this title match. The other thing that got it over so well was Bill Watt announcing that Ted DiBiase had clamored for a world title shot for years. He wasn't going to give this one up. He said that, you know, when Roberto Duran quit in New Orleans again in his fight with Sugar Ray Leonard over stomach cramps, it made his stomach turn, and Ted DiBiase wasn't like that. Watts was incredibly effective in getting that over.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It was just... It's some of the best wrestling television you'll ever see. I mean,
oh, and you know what?
2 weeks worth.
Again, basic psychology. The easiest way I can get you to look at something is say, "Don't look at that." Bill Watts told you if you had if you couldn't stand the sight of blood, if you had maybe I don't know a weak stomach, don't watch this match because Ted DiBiase has had a pressure bandage applied to his head, and that could come off at any time.
And it did.
Of course it did.
That's the truth. And yes, it transformed Ted DiBiase and Dick Murdoch into this big double turn. And while they're in Japan and this turn is being built up on television, Reed and Slater are still battling it out. They're going to war, having hellacious matches in Houston, New Orleans, the Oklahoma. And there's a TV taping, the first ever TV taping outside Irish Mendel's Boys Club in Tulsa on December 18th. And this is a match that actually happened. It was a hell of a match, too. Butch Reed and Jake the Snake Roberts over Ric Flair and Dick Slater.
I have never seen that. I probably have that somewhere. But yeah, Mid-South was so much better. I love the studio wrestling, but it's 1985. We're in a wrestling war. You've got to look major league. And they had to move out of the Irish McNeil's Boys Club. It looked much better.
Yeah, once they went to the buildings, that definitely was a big plus. And then, but Reed's doing loosely town matches now. And Reed's losing. Baton Rouge on the 28th. Lordy Mungus, Buzz Sawyer, and Dick Slater over Hacksaw Duggan, Butch Reed, and Jake Roberts. Then Dick Slater over Butch Reed in Houston on the 29th. Dog Collar Match, Oklahoma City, Buzz Sawyer over Butch Reed. And then January 1st, 1986, Tulsa Convention Center. Dick Slater becomes new North American Heavyweight Champion, beating Butch Reed at with help from Dark Journey's boots.
Mm-hmm.
And what were your thoughts about that title change and Dick Slater being North American champion?
Well, first of all, Dick Slater, I think, again, definitely filled the shoes of North American champion. He'd been the top heel and champion pretty much everywhere he had gone. He was the Georgia heavyweight champion. He was the Southern heavyweight champion in Florida. He, 84 is the U.S. champion up in Crockett. I would have seen Dick Slater as an acceptable NWA world heavyweight champion. So obviously I think highly of the guy. At this point, when Dick hit the iceberg, you know, he sank quickly.
And as we're talking about him, because him and Butch about did that at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was outstanding. He's one of my all-time favorites. And I love Dick Slater. And yeah, I mean, he was really, really good in this role here. But this is Butch Reed leaving Watts.
Mm-hmm.
This is the end. And the reason for that was, according to Bill Watts' book, Butch Reed's wife was sick and tired of Butch's bad drug addictions and told him that he had to come home. If he didn't come home, that she was going to divorce him. And he had to leave, and he went home. He went back to Missouri, and basically, I think he went to rehab. For a month, because he was not around anywhere, and from what I heard, he had went some type of rehab or some type of got some help, and he just magically shows up in Central States of all places again in February. That's a fall from grace. You know, the guy is one of the best in the world, you know, for a solid year and a half in Mid-South, you know, a high-ranking territory. You know, some of the best television around, darling of the newsletters, and now he's back working in basically the Siberia of wrestling.
Yeah, and again, I basically Butch Reed more or less confirmed that story I have heard in his shoot interview that his wife demanded that he go home. And like I said, it was almost like it was one of those weird things where someone was just obviously too big for a particular territory. It was like Dusty Rhodes showing up in the AWA in 1989. It's like, what is this guy doing here? You know, and for a long time, that was, you know, before I started getting the newsletters or whatever, that was like, you know, the ultimate pro wrestling mystery. What happened?
Well, you know, the perfect parallel to this, Barry Windham at the same time in Florida.
Oh, there you go. Excuse me. Actually, I sort of knew what happened with Barry. I mean, he was on the cover of magazines trashing Vince McMahon, and apparently his separation with Dusty in Mid-Atlantic didn't go too well. So,
well, that's why. Yeah, Dusty still had a hard-on for him. You know, he went. So, yeah, that's why he was basically, you know, the only place he could really work on a regular basis was Florida at the time.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, as much I think the world of Barry Windham, but I mean, Butch Reed just had such an upside and he showed it in Mid-South. And now we see his career just going, I don't want to say completely down the tubes, but at this moment, it was almost like he wasn't the same Butch Reed.
Yeah. And like I said, he's going from feuding with Dick Slater, Ric Flair, Dick Murdoch, Buzz Sawyer, to now teaming with Rufus R. Jones and feuding with Art Cruz and Timothy Flowers.
It's almost surreal.
In front of 300 fans in Independence, Missouri.
Yeah. And I remember in 86 reading in one of the magazines that he was doing this and being like, why isn't the NWA bringing this guy in? He would be a perfect fit for that promotion.
Oh, God, imagine him at Crockett. Jesus. Imagine, I think of him getting Jimmy Garvin's spot in Crockett.
Like in 87?
No, 86. No, Jimmy Garvin came in early 86. Imagine them giving Butch Reed the Jimmy Garvin spot.
I think he could have gone. I think he could have done much better than that. I think he.
I know, but I'm saying. I mean, I'm just saying that his roster spot. That's what I'm meaning. And bringing him in instead of Garvin. I mean, not exactly the same push. Although, in all fairness, they did push Jimmy Garvin pretty strong for a while there.
Yes, they definitely did.
I mean, he was.
I think if
feuding with Wahoo and stuff like that, and then Magnum.
Yeah, I mean, I actually would have had bigger ambitions for Butch Reed. I mean, I think if they had brought him in 86 as a babyface, he could have supplanted Magnum TA as the number two guy.
Yeah.
Or that, worst case scenario, number three.
Yeah, he would. Yeah, that's, you know, if they brought him in as a babyface, definitely, for sure. Yeah. So.
And Crockett, at the time, was, I thought they were much stronger on the heel side than the babyface side. So I think Reed would have made more sense over there, at least to start.
Yeah, once you had Dusty and Magnum, you go to Garvin, Ronnie Garvin, Wahoo, Jimmy Valiant. You know.
Yeah, just a bunch
Sam
of guys
Houston,
at the same level.
Yeah, Sam Houston, you know, guys like that. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, him as a babyface would have been really good in Crockett, for sure.
Yeah, I think he would have gotten out of that, you know, Manny Fernandez, Ron Garvin, Wahoo McDaniel type level. He would have been way above that.
Yeah. So, he's with Rufus. They're feuding with Central States Tag Champions, Hacksaw Higgins and J.R. Hogg. And he turns on Rufus and picks up this manager named Slick.
Yep.
And he's doing gimmick matches with Rufus around the horn. Rufus is beating him because he's on his way out. You're going through September. Here he is with teaming with Bulldog Bob Brown, losing to Mike George and DJ Peterson. That's his last Central States match I have on record. But wow. Butch was there for a good chunk of 86 and then shows up. Slick shows up first on September 16th, 1986, and he talks about he's going to be talking about bringing in Butch Reed. Butch makes his debut that night, beating Big Bill Tab, the longtime Crockett jobber. And Butch Reed is now sporting I'm trying to remember, did he have the blonde do when he came in, or did they dye it blonde after he came in? I can't remember.
The first time I saw Butch Reed in the WWF, he had the blonde hair, and I thought it was beyond stupid and ridiculous. And you gotta remember, you know, it was a different time where, you know, like, you know, wacky hairstyles were, you know, less tolerated or accepted, I guess, than they were today. And I remember seeing him with Slick, who I at the time I didn't like. I thought the whole gimmick was stupid. And he comes in with that hair, and I'm like, oh my God, what's happened to you, Butch Reed? It's like, you know, bumping into your high school girlfriend 10 years later, and she, you know, weighs 200 pounds or whatever. It was terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, and the guys he's programmed with early are Tito Santana and Dick Slater.
Yeah.
Working as the Rebel. Talk about your falls from grace. And these were like matches that were second on the card. Think about that.
Yeah. And these, you know, Reed, again, Slater and Reed are two guys that I saw as potential NWA champions. And they go to the WWF. And I understand why they do it, because, you know, that's where the money was. But the WWF just, you know, made them look ridiculous.
Yeah. And, I mean, Reed did have some, you know, some kind of high profile-ish matches as in six man tags and stuff. I mean, his WrestleMania match was with Coco, which it only went 3 minutes or so, and had to beat him using the tights of all things. And I love Coco Ware, but Butch Reed shouldn't be winning something like that. I mean. He needs to be dominant. And it just, you could tell that he wasn't into this. But I will say this, that he did get, he did get a nice little feud with Tito out of it. I mean, they did have some pretty good little matches.
Yes.
I will say that.
I remember seeing one.
You saw it.
Yeah.
You saw the glimpse there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Santana was a great worker, but I remember that match was on, I don't think it was Primetime Wrestling yet. I think it was still TNT, but they had that at the end of 86, and I remember watching it and thinking, wow, that's good.
How about this? Bruno beat Butch Reed in Toronto on June 7, 1987.
Wow. That's definitely weird, because Bruno, my understanding was that they didn't really want him outside of the Northeast.
Well, Toronto, Bruno was a big star in Toronto.
That's true, too. Do you think, I was going to say, do you think he was substituting for anybody? But no, that wouldn't make sense either.
It didn't say, no.
All right.
It's funny, Duggan comes in, and one of the first guys that Duggan works is Reed.
Yep.
And then we get the big Butch Reed feud. Superstar Billy Graham makes his return to WWF, and he's back from his hip surgery, and Butch Reed attacks him with his crutch. What did you think about that whole deal?
Would you believe I saw a really good Butch Reed versus Superstar Billy Graham match at the Boston Garden?
Would I believe it? With Butch Reed being involved, I can believe it. But in 1987, it's kind of tough. But go ahead and tell me.
I was very surprised. It was a really good – I mean, when I say really good match – probably 2.5-3 stars, but still, that was good by WWF standards. And Superstar Billy Graham could barely walk, so it was me and my friends were all very surprised, but pleasantly surprised, obviously.
Think about this, all right? You know, when Graham originally was coming back in, there was plans that they were going to put him against Hogan in a feud. Could you imagine how those matches would have been?
I know they would have been. My understanding was, though, that they were at least initially going to bring him in as a babyface, and they were going to put the Intercontinental title on him. They were going to program him with Savage.
Wow. My favorite one was the one we talked about Between the Sheets a couple weeks ago. Where it was last week, when we did 1987, where Dave was talking about how there was a thought that they were going to put him with Rick Martel as the new Can-Am Connection. Think about that!
Ouch. Oh, I hope that's not God. True, but you never know.
Yeah, Dave was mentioning that in The Observer. I think that was Dave, more or less Dave, saying that, not the promotion. I think he was thinking that would have been a good idea. Which, wow, Dave.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting match with Reed during this whole Superstar Billy Graham thing, and I guess in doing that, they're letting Reed get some better matches. He takes Savage to a draw in Portland on July 2nd, 1987.
They always did weird stuff in Portland, that WWF. I'm sorry, Oregon.
Yeah, Portland, Oregon.
Okay, wrong Portland then. That's a bit of...
Yeah, I forgot about Portland, Maine. That's right, yeah, Portland, Oregon, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a weird pairing, because by this point, most of the top WWF matches were based on programs. Something happened on television, there was a reason these guys were in the ring as opposed to, just having a match.
Yeah. But here's the weirdest of them all. Butch Reed worked the July 4th show in Dallas at the Sportatorium for World Class. Now, there was some type of deal going on. Ricky Steamboat worked the October Cotton Bowl show.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. No, this is – okay. No wonder. This is the wrong date. I was looking at July 4th, 1986, not 1987. Excuse me. But still, okay, yeah, here he is winning World Class, though, during that Central States run. That's interesting looking back now. I wonder how I had that. It's 87. That's odd. But, yeah, he was there. That would have been a better spot for him than the fucking Central States.
maybe not if you're trying to get away from drugs. I don't know.
True. Yeah,
just saying.
You're right. You're right. But, yeah, get back to Reed and Superstar Billy Graham. They did a pretty strong house at the Garden. which we talked about in Between the Sheets, with their the cage match. I mean, I guess it was all on Graham because of who he was, but yeah, I mean that's. It's good that Reed at least had something. I mean, they did. You look at that. They did 18,000 seat attendance on the show. It was them and Hawkey and Steamboat.
Yeah, then and
those are your top two matches.
The Boston match, they were the main event. I don't remember what else was on that show that could have been a draw, but I remember it drew a strong crowd, the Boston Garden.
Yeah, and if he wasn't working Billy Graham, his regular opponent at this time period was Billy Jack Haynes. And that's another guy who was just completely fallen off the cliff.
Yeah, really.
By this time and place.
Oh, well, we know the explanation for that. You can only walk out on so many promotions and you know before you run out of options.
Oh, yes. And yeah, the real big Garden crowd that they drew was 19,700 for the cage match on October 16th. Because your other big match in that card was Strikeforce and the Islanders in a 3-out-of-3-falls match.
Okay, that sounds like pretty much the same show I saw in Boston. So if Strikeforce and the Islanders is second down, I mean, Reed and Graham drew.
There you go. So successful on Reed's part. And the Reed and Graham feud went for quite a while here. I mean, it was going July, August, September, October. Here they are in November. And, yeah, it's going all around the major markets. And but you're also starting to see Reed. All right, now Reed's program with Morocco. Morocco's, you know, babyface now. Morocco's beating him. Bam Bam Bigelow's beating him in different cities. And here's an interesting Reed match. Reed did get a Hogan match. He got Hogan in Hamilton, Ontario at the Cops Coliseum, which I think that aired on WWE 24/7, if I'm not mistaken. I think it did. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure if it did either. If it did, I'd definitely love to see it at some point. But, yeah, you could tell Reed, after the Graham feud, for whatever reason, he wasn't getting pushed anymore.
Yeah, he was basically jobbing the Don Morocco around the horn. And Judge Jake Roberts beating him. Another Hogan match. Let me see where Hogan here got him. Hollywood, Florida, at the Sportatorium.
All right.
They drew 10,000 fans with that match. So
another point, too, in the first Survivor Series, Reed was in the main event.
Yes. That's right. He was part of that team. Yeah, the Andre the Giant and Rick Rude. And yeah, you know, that team, and they did do a little Bigelow Morocco versus Reed and One Man Gang was a feud that went around the horn here.
Yeah, and you know the Survivor Series, the first one, they parceled it out pretty clearly. That was the top five babyfaces against the top five heels. Then the second match down was the next five babyfaces against the next five heels. So that at the time, I mean, it looked pretty good for Reed, but it fizzled rather quickly after that.
Yeah, and you look at WrestleMania 4, he's in the WF Heavyweight title tournament, but Savage puts him out in 4 minutes.
Yeah. Now, was he around the WWF much after that?
That was the last booking.
That was last night.
Yeah, that was his last night. So now, Reed's gone. And Butch Reed is basically disappears.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if this was the time period when he started doing the rodeo stuff.
Yes, it was.
More often. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So he's doing more of his rodeo gimmicks. And he's gone for the rest of 1988.
Uh-huh.
Then all of a sudden, he shows up on NWA television right after the buyout in January 1989. George Scott's the booker. He brings in Butch Reed. Now, we can criticize, you know, George Scott for some of the stuff he did, but I've recently rewatched all this stuff. Butch Reed was in great shape. Butch Reed looked like the old Butch Reed. And it looked like they were going to do something with him. They put him with J.J. Dillon originally. And, you know, of course, the Horsemen were not in existence anymore. Basically, it was just Flair and Barry. And Kendall had turned. But they brought in Butch Reed. He's with J.J. Dillon. And what did you think about Butch Reed finally going to the NWA?
I liked it, even though some of my enthusiasm that I had for Reed years back had waned because, you know, as you can tell, I was not a big proponent of his WWF run. However, I can tell you at least what at some point was on the board for Butch Reed in the NWA, and it's pretty big. And it sounds like you haven't heard this before. Now, mind you, things changed quickly in the NWA back then. You know, they're doing all kinds of transitioning. Just giving you one example, the plan of Eddie Gilbert turning heel in 1989 was ditched.
Yeah, I've been watching that television.
Yeah, it was ditched the day of the pay-per-view. We were all in Philadelphia the night before the show. What can I tell you? Some of the people in my little group knew Eddie, and they all knew he was turning the next day, and he didn't. And they just ditched it at the last minute. That was the nature of the NWA. Just because they were talking about doing something, you know, don't count it until it's on tape. But the plan was that Butch Reed was going to be part of the Four Horsemen. The Four Horsemen consisting of – this is going to sound like a prank, but it's not. It was going to be Dusty Rhodes, who was turning heel, Butch Reed, Bob Orton Jr., and who am I forgetting? Barry Windham. And it was going to be a cowboy outfit. You think I'm ribbing you, but I'm not. How do I put this? Not to sound too vain, but at this time, I was very plugged into what was going on in Atlanta. And this was, at one point, this was the plan that they were going to do those guys as the Four Horsemen.
And Dusty quitting pretty much killed that dead.
Yes.
Because people think that Dusty, once he got fired as Booker, that was it. No.
No.
Dusty was still there for a month after that happened.
Yeah, and I think when Dusty, you know, was deliberately insubordinate and did the angle with the Road Warriors, you know, they fired him as Booker. They kept him around as wrestler. Anyone in any business, going from being the boss to just being one of the guys, it doesn't work. And after what he did as far as the Road Warriors angle, you have to ask yourself, you know, do you really trust this guy to have him in a top spot? Because, you know, he was going to be one of, if not the lead heel.
Which would have been amazing to watch.
And
I mean, for different reasons. I mean, because Dusty had been the top babyface for so long.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't been heel in, at that time, 14 years. Wow.
Yeah, and I had heard that, you know, they were talking to him about, you know, a new contract, and it was going to be in the contract, Dusty, you are going to be one of the bad guys. They specifically did not want him in the babyface role anymore. They felt like it interfered with his objectivity as Booker, ha, ha, ha. You know, not that that wouldn't go on the heel side anyway, but that's what they were going to do.
And, of course, that didn't happen. Flair, you know, stays heel. Windham is still there. Reed joins in. And Orton comes in later. But J.J. Dillon leaves.
Yep.
And we have a new manager for this group. As they get this Japanese money, the Yamazaki Corporation and Hiro Matsuda. And that's quite a shift from J.J. Dillon to Hiro Matsuda.
Hiro Matsuda translated to English means invisible man. I don't know if you knew that.
I think the best Hiro Matsuda stuff that they did in that era was when he was scouting Michael Hayes, and they showed the camera shots of him, and he's standing there and he has the same expression on his face throughout the whole thing. He just looks like a statue.
And, you know, it just goes to show, I mean, I don't hate Jim Herd the way, you know, a lot of people do and maybe should, but this was one of his, you know, I almost hate to say, oh, you're not in the wrestling business, you don't know what you're doing, because that's like such a fallback on the wrestler's part. But here's a guy, Jim Herd, picks up his USA Today, and, you know, they're all worried that the Japanese are taking over, and he's like, oh, we're doing an angle on this. I'm like, wrestling fans don't care about that.
And what was the interesting deal about this in the early Butch Reed era here was he was programmed to work against Sting at Shotdown Rumble. And you have Sting on television who's openly complaining that Butch Reed isn't talking about him or isn't showing any fire. It's crazy to watch him doing that. He said, I'm just, give me a reason to fight you. That's what Sting is saying. And of course, they do shoot an angle, but that's what. I was like, what?
I must give have cursed that from my memory.
Yeah, I tell you, I've gotten every single episode of World Championship Wrestling, you know, from pretty much almost the entire run recently on DVD. And, yeah, those are some interesting shows. The end run at Techwood, those are, oh, boy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Sting saying, give me a reason to fight you. Give me a reason to get motivated.
That is some very disjointed stuff. I just talked about Herd. He obviously always had the worst ideas, but the one idea he had that I thought was a good idea was to close WCW down when they first bought it for maybe, I don't know, 4, 8, 12 weeks and just run like best ofs for TV for a while. It's almost like a restaurant putting up a sign closed for renovations instead of, but you know, that's the downside of being in the wrestling business. Well, you're thinking outside the box, Jim, we can't do that. You know, and I thought that would have been a good idea.
At least a month, I think.
Yeah.
I think at least 1 month.
Yeah.
You know, do it, you know, it's not that hard.
And just have like a countdown.
Use your recent pay-per-views or whatever and clashes.
Yeah, and have a countdown at the bottom of the screen. You know, World Championship Wrestling goes live again in, you know, 17 days. And, you know, have the seconds ticking down or whatever. And do a reboot.
Oh, there's so much that could have been done. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But that's a whole – that's multiple shows right there talking about that. Well, as it goes on, 89, Sting and Reed are working all over the place, and Sting's beating him pretty much every time. Then we have the Clash at the Superdome on April 2nd, 89. And what's the natural match to run at the Superdome in New Orleans? Junkyard Dog and Butch Reed. And this was not 1984 Junkyard Dog and Butch Reed. That's for sure. And although we did get that cool interest with JYD and the New Orleans Jazz Band, but that Clash show, what a train wreck.
Yeah, it was. It's a basic, what's the word, back then, I had heard from a couple of people that your basic shelf life of a wrestling fan is 3 years. Obviously, there are exceptions both ways, but in 3 years, the fan has seen it all and they turn off. So your average New Orleans fan from New Orleans is not going to say, oh, let's go out and see these guys that used to be a big deal back before I watched.
And that's a good point. And that's probably a totally different fan base, too, because it had been 2 years since UWF closed down, and it had been, you know, 3+ years since Butch Reed had been a big deal there, and JYD, you know, still a legend, but it's still JYD past his prime. So it's kind of like, I don't know if I would say sad is the word. But it's just not what it was.
Not even close. Know? And he had been on WWF TV for a long time. He kind of was exposed as just not a top guy anymore. He came across as a retread. And what else was I going to say? I mean, that's basically it. You know, that he came across as an old WWF guy that they were trying to blow the dust off of.
Yeah. Now, one of the final Butch Reed moments in this era on NWA television was him and Bob Orton Jr. were supposed to face the Midnight Express in the NWA World Tag Team Title Tournament. This is the Midnight's first match back after being gone for a few weeks, trying to recharge their batteries. And they did this angle where Murdoch attacked Bob Orton, and Reed had to get Teddy Long had to get Reed a tag partner, because Teddy Long was kind of loosely affiliated with Butch Reed at the time.
Yep.
It shows you how much things were changing. Teddy Long had been had hooked up with Butch Reed and Ron Simmons right here, and then that was dropped immediately. But he brings in the masked jobber, the Raider. And you knew them. I mean, it was pretty much Squash City. And Reed and the Raider lose. And then that's about the end of Butch Reed as a television performer and at this point in time. Now, he's still doing house show stuff. He's got matches with Ricky Steamboat. And, you know, in some big buildings, he's teaming with Ron Simmons on house shows. And he goes off for a bit, and he comes back in September working house shows, beating Scott Hall, of all things, on some house shows. And then these two big masked black men show up at Halloween Havoc.
I was there.
And you were there. And it was Doom. And they had I'm right now watching the last episode of World Championship Wrestling I've watched. Was the Saturday before Halloween Havoc. And they're playing it up as who is going to be Doom. Kevin Sullivan has procured these guys for Woman. And we get to Halloween Havoc, and they face the Steiner Brothers. And you see who it is. It's two big masked black guys, and you immediately know who it is. I mean, do you think they should have went with the mask? Or should they just had him unmasked so, you know, people's intelligence wouldn't be insulted? Because that was basically an insult to everybody's intelligence.
As soon as they came out in the masks, literally everyone around me in the arena started screaming Butch Reed and Ron Simmons. So there's so much for the newsletters exposing the business. I mean, these are like 8-year-old kids, you know? And I remember the gimmick came across as just terrible. The name, at first, I thought the name Doom was terrible. To this day, I think the name Woman is terrible. So I was just like, oh my God, another bad idea has been rolled out by this company. But yet, they turned it around.
Oh, they sure did. But the early stages of Doom, though, was interesting to watch because they're with Woman. They're feuding with the Steiners. Nitron comes out as their bodyguard. Well, that was not very good.
No.
And they had this deal where they're kind of loosely affiliated with the Skyscrapers and against the Steiners and the Road Warriors, leading to Starrcade, where they have that the Iron Man series, or they had the singles and the tag team.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another bad deal there. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think one would have been sufficient, but to do two of them. I mean, what did you think about the Starrcade 89 setup?
I'm the only person still alive who actually liked Starrcade 89. I don't think they should have done it as a Starrcade, but I actually enjoyed the concept. It came across as a legitimate sporting event. I actually thought the singles part of it – no, actually both the singles and the tag team were both booked pretty well. So I know I'm in the minority there, but I actually enjoyed the show.
Doom lost twice. They lost to the Road Warriors and to the Samoan SWAT team.
Yeah. Oh, and you know what? It kind of showed, at least at the time, it seemed like they were just giving up on these guys and the whole gimmick. Did they still have – no, they lost the masks at the November Clash. Am I right?
No.
Ah, okay.
They lost the mask at the Corpus Christi Clash.
The February 91?
Yes.
Okay, so they were still in the mask gimmick. And, you know, I mean, to me, that was just – it was terrible. And, I mean, it was their rightful place in the world, losing a couple of matches in one night.
Yeah, it was – I mean, they did all this hyping for Doom, and, it, they did these big angles with Woman, and then, you know, that happens.
Yeah.
And they decide to, you know, they do the transition where Woman is going to, with Ric Flair, and Doom then loses their mask to the Steiners at the Corpus Christi Clash. And then they show up, at, Wrestle War.
Yep.
And tuxedos to, get involved in the, Road Warrior Skyscraper Chicago Street Fight. And Doom and Road Warrior seem like a natural feud to me. I mean, it's the Legion of Doom against Doom.
No, I see that.
I mean, yeah, because of name reasons. But I thought that those two teams worked together, although the Road Warriors were pretty much at this time period zoning out and ready to get out of there. But what did you think about the Road Warriors Doom feud?
I liked it. I thought coming in that Doom was going to be just like, you know, something to feed the Road Warriors, you know, an interesting, a competitive enough match, but you know who's going to win. But we talked about earlier how when Skip Young took off his mask, he lost all his charisma. Without the mask, Mr. Olympia just didn't have the charisma. Doom was the exact polaric opposite. As soon as they got rid of those masks, those guys came to life.
And got Teddy Long as their manager.
Yeah, Teddy Long, and that was a great dynamic. An important part of that package, absolutely.
Yeah, and so he goes from them to the Skyscrapers. I mean, from the Skyscrapers to them. So he's leaving at that, and that night, the Skyscrapers at that show was Mean Mark Callis, who would grow up to become The Undertaker, and Mike Enos under a mask.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that the Skyscrapers, you know, when they first were put together, it looked like, you know, they put together a phenomenal team of two promising young guys that were going to be future stars, and it looked like a good first step for them. And that tag team just, like, you know, slowly but surely sank until, yeah, we've got Mark Callis and a guy under a mask being the Skyscrapers.
Yeah. And I'm looking at, I'm going through the house shows and stuff from 1990. Doom is losing almost every time to the Road Warriors.
Which makes sense.
This is something to want. It makes sense for house shows, yeah. But it's just interesting because the Road Warriors, you know, are getting ready to leave. And they're just beating them at the house shows like crazy.
I'm just wondering if at that time they knew the Road Warriors were leaving. Probably, come to think of it. What are we looking at? Like April, May of 90?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And how about this? April 26, 1990 at the Meadowlands. The first show in the New York market in 2 years. You're supposed to have the Road Warriors against Doom. Road Warrior Hall failed his EKG in the pre-match physical, and they would not let him compete. So it was Animal against Butch Reed. Animal goes over by DQ. Hawk was the second. Ron Simmons was the second. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, again, this is something we could talk about all night, and I'd rather not. But, I mean, why is it that Road Warrior Hawk could wrestle everywhere else and he's fine, but in the state of New Jersey, because they have an athletic commission with all kinds of weird rules, he can't work? That's just silly.
Yeah, it was weird. Well, Doom got the gold at Capital Combat 90. They beat the Steiner Brothers, and now the new World Tag Team Champions. And, this began a pretty strong run. I remember as a kid in this era thinking Doom was like the shit. Because now, I mean, with Teddy as the champions, they were starting to plow through everybody. They were getting more dominant on television. They built this mystique and this aura up of being the baddest guys around. And it helped out too, because the guys they were putting against like the Rock and Roll Express. I know they worked them in the Great American Bash. They were feuding with they got shots against the Southern Boys, you know, Steve and Tracy. And that was kind of smart, I think, to put them against smaller guys to make them look more impressive. I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. And that's, you know, a basic wrestling premise, you have the smaller, brave babyface taking on the great big guy who fights Jerry.
Yeah, and the deal here is that basically Doom has cleaned out the babyfaces. They beat all the babyface tag teams. They beat the Rock and Rolls. They beat the Southern Boys. They beat the Steiner Brothers. Well, who's left? Well, how about a tag team of Ric Flair and Arn Anderson?
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that went into this was so good. I mean, and the fact that they kept it heel versus heel was also a credit to them. You know, the fans were still, you know, the fans were cheering Flair and Arn in some places, but in other places, like especially like of Atlanta, they were cheering for Doom.
Yeah, yo,
it was an interesting dynamic to watch.
You know, let me backtrack a little bit. I went to a show, and it was the Friday of Memorial Day weekend in 1990 at Boston University. The NWA came up there, and it was the Steiners against Doom. And somehow, BU, while they had a football team, their football team was like by the heel locker room. And these guys were trying to pick a fight with Simmons and Reed. I was like, oh my God, you picked the wrong two guys. I bet they would have taken every single one of those guys on and tore them apart. But it was a kind of a scary situation. It was escalating and getting out of hand. And because there were like 50 football players, security was overwhelmed. And I'm like, oh, you guys better pray security keeps you back. You will get hurt by these two.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, that's two guys that wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley, for sure.
I mean, Ron Simmons. Well, you know, he was, what, sixth in the Heisman voting as a defensive tackle? That's a tough guy.
Yes.
So, anyway, yes. The Flair and Arn thing, I enjoyed the feud. It was something different, not only in its presentation, but you were really doing something with Ric Flair for the first time, that he was fresh in that role. He's in a tag team, and he's taking on two guys that, I mean, aside from what was going on with Reed 5 years ago, that were totally fresh to him. And Reed had a whole new persona, so it didn't matter anyway.
Yeah, and the thing was, it basically started like on the Danger Zone when Teddy Long comes out, you know, interrupting Flair and Arn and talking about you know, his guys were the, you know, best tag team, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was just an interesting deal to watch because, you know, Flair and Arn were never a tag team, at least regularly. I mean, yeah, they teamed on house shows, but they weren't a regular tag team. And Teddy Long's up there basically saying that Flair and Arn hasn't proven themselves. You know, it's a real interesting dynamic to watch. Because Flair, of course, had been forever, you know, the guy in singles, the world heavyweight champion. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting to see the horsemen portrayed in this way as being like underdogs.
Yeah, underdogs
against the heels.
Yeah, Flair going for the tag team titles. Now, to me, there's two ways to look at it. There's one way, as a fan, I just sat back and enjoyed it. You know, I liked seeing Flair in a fresh new role. The problem is that the fans in general, the NWA fans, like, didn't accept the idea of Flair going after the tag team titles. Those were something Flair was above them. And that you had that part of it not working.
And then again, it's heel versus heel as well, which is tough sometimes to deal with. And I mean, you look, Halloween Havoc 90 is when they had their big match in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really fun match. And the fans in Chicago were more towards Flair and Arn. So that kind of helped out, that they were kind of with the right people they're supposed to be behind. But, yeah, and that was in the end. They went to that double count out finish, and you thought they were going to go for more. And, of course, it led to the whole Clash of the Champions deal in Jacksonville, where we get was basically a captain's match. They did a coin flip, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Mm-hmm.
and Flair and Reed ended up being the match, which was great because Flair and Reed, you know, and it's in Florida too. So you got that pedigree.
There you go.
And Flair pinned Reed, and Arn interfered. The referee was knocked out the floor. Reed, got hit with a steel chair. After Simmons interfered, I think dropped Flair with a clothesline. In the match, Flair and Anderson got their title shot at Starrcade, and Flair got Teddy Long a chauffeur for a day.
Oh, Rick, why didn't and you if, see what was coming?
Yeah, and the thing was, I was hoping for this one. If Reed won, Long would have won Ric Flair's limo and yacht.
Yeah.
Imagine that skit. But, oh yeah, the deal was that Teddy Long picked up Ric Flair at CNN Center, and he drove him down some side streets in Southwest Atlanta during the day, at least.
Yep.
And Flair got the hell beat out of him.
I remember just rolling my eyes at the silly skit. Like, Flair's going, "Hey, Teddy, where you going? Where you going?" It's like, where do you think he's going, Rick? Are you new to the wrestling business? The really good thing about the I don't mean to get ahead of myself with the Starrcade match, but the Steiners versus Doom match that I saw live, the Halloween Havoc match and the Starrcade match, Doom was giving it and taking it. They were stiffing the crap out of each other.
Oh God, yeah.
Those guys were working hard and dishing out and taking their lumps, and that's what made the matches really good.
Yeah, and we go to Starrcade. And they announced on the show that Ric Flair has withdrawn himself from the match due to the attack from Doom, and that Barry Windham was replacing him. And they have a street fight, which Doom basically went to a no contest. Only went 7:35. Simmons pinned Anderson with a clothesline. Anderson came on top at the same time. Windham had Reed inside cradle, so double pinfall. And they brawl their way backstage. Now, Flair's out of this feud now because, of course, he's the Black Scorpion, wins title from Sting. But it gives this a new dynamic. And it now it's transitioned now to Arn and Windham.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to tell you this. If you've never seen the Arn Anderson, Barry Windham, Back to the Streets promos.
One of my favorite of all time.
That aired on WCW television in January 91, where the Horsemen are getting tough again. Ric Flair don't wear suits no more. Ric Flair don't have long hair no more. You know, Ric Flair cut his hair. I mean, the Horsemen are getting back in the streets again. And Arn and Barry, and they're black and white. And they go to, like, some of the shantiest towns in Southwest Atlanta. And Arn Anderson walks out of this one place that, I heard Teddy Long owns this dump, you know, and they're beating up cars and shit with pipes. Fantastic.
I remember was like, they were doing the interview, and someone like kind of looked out the window, and they left, and Windham walks up to the window, knocks on it, and smiles inside. It was hilarious. Like, you dared him to come out.
I think that feud had some life, and they cut it off quick. Real quick.
Yeah. Yeah, 1990.
I mean, it's amazing how quick they cut.
I would say, you know, starting, oh man, like right around the middle of 1990, yeah, WCW, they had some good spots, like the ones we've been talking about, but right around the middle of 1990, that promotion just cratered, and by the end of 1990, like I said, bright spot here and there, but overall, they were just awful.
And, of course, the man in charge, a booker named Ole.
Oh, you know what? That was the turning point. What am I talking about? That's exactly when it happened.
A booker named Ole.
Yeah, no jumping off the top rope. Work the arm like it's 1974. Hey, let's sing some doo-wop. Come on.
So now, you know, they're doing this Doom, Arn, and Barry feud. And like I said, it's building the, you know, they're. Looks like it's going to be, you know, really fun stuff. Now we get a booking change.
Yep.
Dusty's back. And Dusty, in his infinite wisdom, decides he's going to break Doom up, which came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And Doom loses the NWA World Tag Team titles to a mystery team at I think they did the title change at WrestleWar, but they did title changes on television before it, to the TV tapings. This is one of those infamous deals where you had guys winning belts before they actually lost them.
Yeah.
But Michael Hayes and Doom, Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin, the new Fabulous Freebirds, even though they weren't new, defeated Doom to win the titles in 657. They had done this little deal where they were starting to build the dissension between Butch and Ron, that Teddy Long was being too busy with other outside interests. Ron Simmons was getting frustrated. And the Birds with Big Daddy Dink, Sir Oliver Humperdinck, and DDP, and the Diamond Dolls, and all that shenanigans, they beat Doom. Reed accidentally hit Simmons with a foreign object, which was thrown in by Long. And this is pretty much the end of Doom right here.
Yeah.
And what a way to end it, huh?
I thought that that incarnation of the Freebirds was absolutely horrible. Not compared to previous incarnations of the Freebirds, just horrible in general. I can't believe how much TV time that awful act got. Hayes had nothing left. He couldn't even do interviews anymore. Garvin was obviously phoning it in. I like Jimmy Garvin, and I like Michael Hayes overall, but I mean, one of my friends made a joke about Michael Hayes at the end of 89. He said, this guy's going to be the Jimmy Valiant of the 90s, and he wasn't even that.
No. And it's something to watch Hayes' transformation too, you know, in that time period. I mean, the Freebirds, they were something else. But the one match that I skipped over, and I didn't mean to, but we gotta go back to it, was Doom's last Clash match, Clash 14 in Gainesville at the Georgia Mountain Center, where they faced Sting and Lex Luger.
Oh,
and it actually went about 10 minutes, but I thought that was a really fun match.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot about it, but I don't remember anything bad about it.
Well, Dan Spivey, well, that's when he made his surprise return and attacked Luger to build up their U.S. title match.
Okay.
At WrestleWar. And you know the story, you remember the story behind why it was in Gainesville, right?
No.
You know, that was the show they were supposed to have at CNN Center.
Okay.
In the atrium, inside the building.
Right, but we had the Gulf War going on.
The Gulf War, and they had to move it out, and then they moved it to all places to Gainesville and Georgia Mountain Center, which was a nice venue, but it wasn't a Clash of the Champions type venue, and the stuff they had planned for entrances and stuff they couldn't do because the building wasn't big enough, but yeah, that happened in January. At the end of January, and they did the title change at WrestleWar in Phoenix on February the 24th, and then the Doom breakup happens right after that. They do have a Tokyo Dome match though against Vader and Bam Bam Bigelow.
That's right.
At that Starrcade show, and Rip Simmons, they get interesting deal here. Simmons said, we signed for this match months ago, and I came to fight, and I hope Butch Reed comes to do the same. I like that. They explained it.
Yep.
That, yeah, we had done this. We had signed this match before we broke up, but we're going to take it anyway.
Yeah, and I remember at the time, a lot of people were like, oh, my God, they moved it out of the CNN Center. What's the matter with those Turner people? It's like, look, not to get political on you, we're kind of used to being at war in 2016, but in 1991, it was kind of new. We hadn't been doing it in 20 years. I do think it would be somewhat inappropriate for a national news agency like CNN to be having something as frivolous as a wrestling show, on their campus while that was going on.
Yeah. Now, of course, Reed did the job in the Tokyo Dome match, and Simmons and Reed brawled with each other, and Simmons left standing tall. And that's basically what was going on here. Is you look at all the house show cards, and it's all Reed doing the job for Ron Simmons, which was the right way to go because you know, Ron is staying and getting a big push, and Butch is going to be out the door soon. And they did their final match at the first Super Brawl in, I think it was Jacksonville. Yeah, no, St. Petersburg. In a steel cage match.
Was that the Flair Fujinami match?
Yes.
Okay.
Teddy Long was in the cage above the ring. He was in Betty Lou. And he threw an object to Reed, but Simmons got a spine buster, and that was pretty much the end of that. And Reed worked some appearances after that, but his last known WCW match of that era was in Houston, of all places, in a steel cage match, teaming with a one-man gang, losing to Junkyard Dog and Ron Simmons.
Oh, boy. Well,
and then Reed left again. And then Reed left again.
Yeah, and, you know, the match that they had, the cage match, even though it was a cage match, to me at the time, it really felt like a throwaway match. You know, wrestling turns, I'm a big – I don't believe in doing a lot of them. Every turn you do, the less each turn means. And it was almost like, oh, what are we going to do? Hey, how about we just turn these guys for no reason? And I kind of definitely went out with a thud. I thought there was no reason to turn Reed. You could have made Reed Simmons, what's the word I'm looking for, his sidekick. I think that would have been more effective.
Yeah. So Reed's gone.
Yeah.
I get, and it's gone for over a year. Then all of a sudden, at Clash 20, at Center Stage on September 2nd, 1992. Here's Butch Reed.
Yeah.
He's the substitutes for Dan Spivey, team with the Barbarian, beating Dustin Rhodes and Barry Windham.
Yeah, this is when Bill Watts was running the show.
Yeah, Bill Watts is there, yes. And that's why Butch is back. And Butch forms a little team with a Super Invader. And he's teaming the Barbarian, so he's aligned with Cactus Jack. And they have some matches against, you know, Rhodes and Windham and all sorts of stuff. Problem was, Butch's appearance only lasted 2 weeks. Because he was fired on September 15th by Bill Watts for no-showing the TV tapings in Macon, Georgia. So right down the road from me. And didn't tell anybody ahead of time.
Well, I mean, it seemed like he I remember this vaguely. It seemed like he didn't want to be there. It was almost like, you know, we were having the ghost or the corpse of Butch Reed out there trying to work matches. He didn't look good in 92 in IMO.
No, he definitely was not the same guy. So he leaves there and goes to work at a place he never really worked before, Memphis. He shows up in USWA. And who is he feuded with there? The Junkyard Dog.
Oh, that's
and
bad.
Beats JYD for the Unified World Heavyweight title on October 12th, 1992. He didn't stay long. Have you ever seen this?
I know I've seen it, and I bet I haven't seen it since 1992. Because I used to get Memphis on a regular basis back then. But yeah, I remember. I barely remember it, but I do remember him being there.
You remember who he lost the title to?
Oh, let me think. I don't remember. Jimmy Valiant.
Todd Champion.
Who?
Todd Champion.
Oh, my word. I was like, please, please tell me he said Chris Champion. And no, he didn't.
Todd Champion. And it wasn't long after that Reed left. And then basically from then on, Reed was... You know, he would appear in wrestling very rarely. He showed up in Global. You remember that when he was in Global?
No, I don't. I didn't like Global.
Well, he was there at the end of the run. He was there in 1994.
Oh man,
where he was the he won the GWF North America title, beating the California Stud Rod Price, and he held the title for a month before he lost it to Chris Adams.
I saw Reed on a Louisiana-based indie that had TV. It was called the NWF, And it was, you know, they had the typical crew of, you know, Reed, Adams, et cetera. And, you know, I guess I can't blame them for booking Reed because he was a big star in Mid-South and on national television at one point. But I remember just looking at Reed and just, you know, it was kind of sad. He had nothing left.
Yeah, and then Reed basically was out of wrestling for the rest of the 90s. He was doing the full-time rodeo stuff. And he just magically appeared in 2001 working for Harley Race.
I did not know
that. His WLW promotion. Yeah, and he was the WLW World Heavyweight Champion for most of 2001. He lost his belt in January to a guy named Dennis McCaws, and then he retired from wrestling after that. He did make a few appearances for a group named Mid-States Wrestling, and then he made his last WWF appearance. Do you remember this, when he was on SmackDown?
No.
September 9, 2007, for the taping of the September 14th show. There was a little skit with Teddy Long, and Butch Reed made a cameo appearance backstage where it was kind of acknowledged of who he was. So yeah, and he had his last match on November 4th, 2011 in some indie group. But the thing about Butch Reed now is that he is one of the guys in the last month to be part of that class action lawsuit. Fought against WWE with, you know, about the traumatic brain injuries, and about how the company concealed the risk of the injury. And what are your thoughts about that? About all those guys doing that?
Well, I mean, I don't blame the guys for at least trying. I mean, what did they have to lose? While I certainly don't think Vince McMahon or the WWF really could be held liable for that. Certainly not in and of themselves. I mean, look at, you know, Reed wrestled for the WWF for what, a year and a half, and his career was how long, you know, and that goes for just about close to everyone on that suit. But what happens in a class action lawsuit is you either get contacted by an attorney, or, you know, you see somewhere where you can contact them. It doesn't cost you anything to put your name on the suit. And who knows, maybe you can get even a small sum of money for nothing out of it. You know, small sum meaning, I don't know, a couple of $100.
Yeah, and they're all aiming for the settlement for sure. But yeah, some of the guys on here is kind of laughable, sadly, and some of the stuff that's being said, like Black Bart saying he worked 10 matches in one night for WWF, which, come on, you know, and some of the other lies is being told, and it's sad. It's a sad end. It's sad that a lot of these guys are having to do that to try to get some money because of how their careers went and how their finances went, that they, you know, trying to, you know, get whatever they can. So,
I mean, I hate that, but. Years ago, I got an email from someone representing or going up against Priceline, I believe it was. And they're like, you know, hey, if you're part of this class action suit, you might get something. Maybe a year later, I got a coupon to use Priceline. That was that was literally my settlement, my big class action lawsuit. But they, again, you know, I never used it, obviously. But that's what these things are all about. You have a medium to large group of defendants that have been harmed, maybe not enough to go after someone individually, but as a group, you know, they get a small, almost consolation prize. So it's just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Butch Reed in the grand picture. When you look at his career, how would you assess it? And just overall thoughts.
Well, I don't want this to sound negative. He was someone who had just, I mean, potential to be One of the all-time biggest names out there. I think he could have been one of the biggest stars in the 80s, and we're talking about as big, maybe not as big as Hogan and Flair, but I think he could have been as big as DiBiase, Steamboat, Piper, Savage, like that level. It just didn't happen. Instead of having a, you know, phenomenally great career, he just had a really good career.
Yeah, it's definitely that, the potential and what could have been.
You know,
it's definitely there, you know, and he had his run, he had the run he had, and you can't deny that, but yeah, he's one of those guys you see like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one of those, it's one of those athletes that, you know, they show so much potential and they have like a bad injury and they're never the same again.
That's a good analogy. Like that.
You know, it's sad, but you know, still, we have a lot of great stuff to look back on with Butch, and go check out whatever you can if you haven't really watched a lot of Butch Reed, because it's well worth it.
Yeah.
All right, John, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I had a blast.
And definitely we'll do something again in the future, because there's a lot of cool stuff we could talk about.
Yeah, definitely.
And I would love to get you to talk about old WWF stuff. I mean, I've always been intrigued by that. Part of that time period of the territory, the late 70s and early 80s, because they're so different compared to what they ended up doing in expansion. So I definitely get you on for something like that. But thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome. Not to put myself over, to use wrestling vernacular, but I can't think of anyone better to talk about that stuff. I started watching in 76, and I just glommed on. I saw so many house shows and so many arena shows, you know, back in the day. And yeah, I was around for the expansion. So
awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely talk about more about that in the future. But anyway, thanks for being on the show. And I'm Chris Zellner, saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.